Let me know when.
Right here. Come on down.
All right, good morning, everybody. I'll call to order the regularly scheduled Board of Supervisors meeting for this Tuesday, June 19th, 2018, and ask if everybody please join the board as we honor America with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, thank you, everybody, and good morning again. Before we get to public comment, one quick change board for our agenda, unless there's objection. I'd like to move emergency quarterly report up to the top. Keith and Melissa have basically been going 24-7 since Thursday, and with the rain today, there's a lot more work to do, so I'd like to get Keith's report done and him out the door.
Sure.
Anybody have a problem with that?
No problem with that.
All right, so we'll slide him to right after public comment number one, which is what we're doing right now. So anybody wishing to address the board on any topic, topics on today's agenda, or if you want to address us on something not on today's agenda, please come right on up to the desk. And seeing no one move to the microphone, we'll move on. First item we're going to deal with is Emergency Management Quarterly Report. Keith Morgan.
Morning, Keith.
Keith, it's been a wild few days.
Hey, yes, it has. And it looks like we've got more on the way, so... Well, as you might guess, I'm going to start off with our responses. Emergency management has shifted to an increased responses due to severe weather, and these events have become more numerous. There have been approximately 10 or 12 severe weather events monitored by our office. Seven of them have generated action by either the coordinator or the deputy, as outlined some of them in the report. The latest event resulted from heavy rains causing flash flooding in Kelly, Ames, and Nevada. Most of the damages have come from flooded basements due to either water flowing across the ground and into egress windows, or water infiltrating through the foundation, or water coming up through drains. Additionally, I've just learned that we received a report that Ames had a pedestrian bridge that was severely damaged, and we're looking into that.
That bridge is sitting in my backyard right now.
It is. Okay. Well, salvage value for that then. Damages to basements often goes underreported, and our office is testing a new web-based app that will allow homeowners to help us collect information on this and other weather-related damages. The data collected will help us evaluate the effectiveness and of our current infrastructure and the need to modify this current infrastructure to meet demands. Additionally, the data helps us support cost benefits justifications that are a part of the hazard mitigation grant process. Our office hopes that over time we can collaborate with jurisdictions to encourage residents to use this system. Additionally, our office responded to a large fire at the Blacks Heritage Farm that started in the structure and migrated to a large number of stored timbers. Due to the rural nature of the fire, water had to be shuttled from a hydrant up in the Ames area approximately 1 mile away to the actual site. And this required seven rigs from all of our different fire departments to conduct this shoveling. And it just demonstrates how we have to have mutual aid and how we have to be interoperable to be able to meet the needs of events here in Story County. Any questions on response?
I have a question about Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
Saw some video on TV last night, and I have not even tried to go down there to get close enough to see. They were talking about the smell. They were talking about it not being able to drain. The residents were. What is the next step for emergency management or anything that the county can do?
We went out there on Sunday and discussed with the mayor the situation that they have there, and it's a combination of the system itself is interlinked to other drainage systems there, and the drainage systems upstream of there have to drain before that drainage system can take it and drop it on down through. I did have a conversation with the mayor this morning, and I am going to reattack with Homeland Security to see if there's a possibility we might be able to get what we call a trash pump out there to try and pull the water off the surface. It's our estimation that if we could pull the water off the surface and get it away from there, then we wouldn't have a problem with water boiling back up from the tiling system that supports there. The problem is it's not quite deep enough to support the use of a trash pump, we think. But we're going to go back to Homeland Security. We're going to see if they have any ideas on how we might be able to pull that surface water off there. And if we do that, we think that until the next round of rain comes, we could lessen the situation, the impact of the situation there.
Right. So 2 points. One, we've got up to 25 homes that potentially could need to be evacuated if the situation got worse.
Yes.
And the second one is, this is inside the city of Kelly, meaning that we don't, emergency management has a role, but they have a role via the mayor and city council in Kelly, not through the Board of Supervisors.
So that wouldn't be part of any request that would come for us to have the county?
It would go from the city of Kelly to emergency management and then be routed on from there.
Okay, thank you.
Now, one of the things that we have done is we, Rick with his hat on as the chair of the commission, has signed a local disaster declaration to cover all of the jurisdictions that have been impacted and potentially could be impacted, so that it just smooths the process. And with that, we will be able to open up what is called the Iowa Individual Assistance Program to those that are 200% of the poverty level and below. And it can offer up to $5,000 to those people for to replace a water heater or things like that that have been damaged. And we work that process through MICA. And the overall damage to even the public structures and like that will be collected, sent up to the state for consideration if the governor should decide to move forward and try and get a presidential disaster declaration.
Sure. And so for us, we've got some damage on roads, and we've got some fairly substantial damage to Tedesco mm-hmm. Environmental Learning Corridors. We're building that out. But our role as supervisors will be on anything that's county-owned property, whether it's within municipality or outside of municipality, or everything that's outside of municipality. If it's inside a municipality, so that disaster declaration actually facilitates key working with the individual jurisdictions, in this case Kelly, to try to gather, which sometimes it's hard to gather information from some of these entities, try to gather the information and be supportive to that entity however possible.
Right. And since we've declared for the whole county, if there are areas in the unincorporated areas, individuals in the unincorporated areas, they would be eligible for this.
Right.
So if there are those people, they should be in contact with your office? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir. We will try and collect them. Well, actually, what we're going to try and do, and I've been working with Alyssa on this, is for the county to have a system also to collect damages from there. So as a jurisdiction, you collect them. I'm working with Nevada and Kelly and Ames also for each of those jurisdictions. If the individuals decide to not utilize the that damage assessment app, then for each jurisdiction to have a conduit to collect that, then I'll collate it all together and we'll push it on forward. The next step really will be for us is to push out information on that individual assistance program. Then those individuals will go directly to MICA, who is designated to implement that program across the county, and then they'll evaluate the individuals to see if they qualify for the program, and then they will get them into the system. And additionally, it's a great marriage, because if they're not available, then MICA can also possibly point them towards other avenues that they might be able to get some assistance.
You alluded to the state designation for disaster area in your conversations with the state, I assume. Do you know where we're at in that process? People have asked, I mean, where are we in the sense that have we had a designation made, or are we in the run-up to one, or is it in all likelihood?
Right now there are 7 counties that have already asked for a governor's proclamation. My conversations with a state duty officer this weekend were that the next step would be what we call a preliminary damage assessment, typically conducted by state officials and the local emergency manager, where we go through and we evaluate the damages that are out there. That information is collected and set on up to the governor. The governor considers it. Then it would go on up to presidential level. And then if it is enacted, then we go back through that process again, bringing the FEMA folks out, and we go around and reevaluate the damage and assess whether FEMA and the president will decide to provide a disaster declaration and open up the programs that are a part of that.
Thank you.
On the planning side, This afternoon, soon after I complete this meeting, I'm headed over to Ames for a planning meeting on RAGBRAI. This is the first time our office has pushed for what we call an Incident Action Plan, an IAP, which you put together for large-scale events. An IAP can be developed for pre-planned events like RAGBRAI, or it is used during times of disaster, and it will stretch over multiple operational periods, again, to coordinate the response. The planning process of developing an IAP has already brought increased situational awareness across a multitude of jurisdictions that are going to be involved with RAGBRAI. This is our office's first time of pushing the development of an IAP, and it allows multiple different agencies a little bit of experience on how we do one of these in slow time, so should we have to pull one together rapidly after a disaster, they'll have more experience with it. And we're hoping that, first off, it improves our capability to respond to anything in RAGBRAI, and secondly, it'll improve our disaster response capability should we have a large-scale disaster. Tied to my previous discussion on the collection of damage reports is another ongoing planning effort, and that's the Hazard Mitigation Plan revision. I know that later in this meeting, you'll be reviewing the county's evaluation of risk you face, which is always a moving target in the dynamic environments of Story County and with our changing weather patterns. The Board of Supervisors and county departments and offices have been working together closely to make significant progress on the hazard mitigation strategies that you all adopted as the board in the last plan. What I find important is that you, as a governmental agency, haven't waited around for assistance to make a lot of these things happen from other agencies, the federal government, or the state. I applaud Story County for doing that, because oftentimes I see everybody waiting around until they get some sort of assistance, some sort of a grant to make things happen. And a lot of what we can do internally to chip away at some of those things that are causing us risk. So I appreciate your efforts on that. Any questions on our planning efforts? Operations. Our office has participated in exercises and planning for potential statewide disasters ranging from cyber, animal disease, or abductions. The tactical aspects of each of these events is significantly different. But the common issues associated with all of them is the integration of external resources and that they involve multiple disciplines across multiple jurisdictions. This is where our office will continue to focus on our core responsibilities, which is, again, the processes associated with interjurisdictional and interagency coordination. I'd like to highlight one of the areas where we have translated what I call lessons identified into lessons learned. As I discussed in my last visit with you, one lesson identified in the after action for the 70-car pileup on I-35 was the need to improve our sheltering capabilities to support our I-35 closure plan. On June 9th, the Coalition for Disaster Recovery, the CDR, conducted training and an exercise for our Rapid Action Teams for Sheltering, our RACs. And it included RATS teams from the First Christian Church in Ames and RATS from Huxley and Story City. The exercise highlighted to the RATS that sheltering involves much more than just setting up a bunch of cots and refreshments. The RATS faced issues like unaccompanied minors, multiple medical and mental health issues, and the media. They adapted well to these challenges and now recognize the need to be proactive and adaptive to whatever environment they might face. Story County has the opportunity to address another lesson identified and turn it into a lesson learned, which is interoperable communications with external agencies. The Deputy EMA attended an after-action for the second I-35 pileup on the Story and Polk County line. A major issue identified in the after-action was the inability of Story and Polk County response agencies to communicate. There were tools available to make that happen, but the radios weren't properly set up for them, procedures weren't developed, and agencies hadn't trained on the system. And that's on both sides of the county line. Story County doesn't have the resources to go it alone if we have a large-scale event. We will have to integrate external resources into our response, and we need to carefully consider these factors as we develop the replacement radio system.
Do you feel like that's being considered as we move through the process of selecting that ultimate radio system, which what everybody needs to know is that's going to be an $8 to $9 million bill all said and done, multiple entities paying in, but Story County is going to have a large chunk of that. Do you feel like the conversation is progressing how you'd like to see it progress to try to address some of these concerns?
I addressed it when I had my opportunity to talk to our consultants on this. We will be setting up the RFP will obviously be fairly generic on that, but some of the stuff that I stressed to them is, again, opportunities to have bridging capabilities to be able to integrate other radio systems. Part of the process is also setting up our radios so that people know that they have this capability to tap into these other agencies. Some of them are just playing the programming of the radios, and that's going to take a collective will amongst all of the agencies within Story County to ensure that we have things like the interop channels that are put in there. So some of it's going to have to become internally, some of it may be externally, and some of it may have a cost associated with it, but we need to evaluate what we need to get to and how we can afford to get there and what's the best way to do it. Usually there's a trade-off between the technical solution that makes it really easy and possibly some that are more driven by our procedures and our training.
So, Keith, going back to Polk had some of the same problems, and then the interaction between the two counties. So we can do everything that we feel is viable, but we may still have problems when we're asking for assistance outside of the county, is what you're saying.
That can happen. What I'm referring to is there's a system that's called a mixed system, the Metro Interoperable Communication System that's resident within Polk County's radio systems. That if radios had been programmed with what we call the national interop frequencies, both sides could have tapped into that. But again, neither side really thought about that and even brought up the concept. So it goes back to the basics on formulating a unified command, practicing communications in a difficult situation so that you know that you've got these resources, you know how to use those resources, and people have enough training to be able to quickly swap over to those resources. It's a very holistic process that, again, starts with your plans, your policies, training the folks on it, and then exercising that on a regular basis.
Thanks.
So what's the way ahead? Guess what? The weather season has, severe weather season has just started, and things are going to remain rain for the rest of the week. I anticipate we'll have many more late nights watching the storms, and our main concern is with large outdoor events such as RAGBRAI. We've asked all the jurisdictions to send us notifications of any large-scale events, and we'll work closely with those events to keep them advised of incoming weather, although they need to have a system to be able to react to the weather that's hitting them right up front. In addition to that, we will continue to work with our first responders to make sure that we are coordinating resources during the national event. We hope the RAGBRAI will be the biggest non-event of the year for our office. But we will spend considerable amount of time and effort up through July to ensure small events stay small, and should we have a large event, that our system can rapidly expand to deal with any problems that we might occur during RAGBRAI. The Local Emergency Planning Committee should be receiving a hazardous commodity flow study in the coming months. I had a chance to preview the report, and we'll have some valuable data to inform both local government, citizens, and our first responders on the type, location, and magnitude of risk that we face due to transportation of hazardous materials within Story County. This data should drive our planning, training, and exercise. In a few days, our office will be working with you, Story County, to begin a workshop that will translate your COOP-COG plan into something that is more than a paper document, and that we hopefully will build the skills to ensure your county government will always function to support the citizens. This workshop is a critical step for all the departments and elected officials to evaluate the effectiveness of the processes that they have in the current plan, and for you, the Board of Supervisors, to also assess county government's ability to integrate across its many different agencies. Finally, Melissa and I will be conducting more EOC training. This training will help EOC staff understand what we call the Interagency Mutual Assistance Compact, the IMAC, which is used to share resources across jurisdictions. Having EOC staff that know the ins and outs of this process It will help us to access resources in a cost-effective manner and also support the documentation that we'll need should we go for reimbursement down the line. So with that, I'll open it up for any questions you might have.
I have none.
I believe that you're very thorough, and I just appreciate what a small staff office is able to do.
Thank you.
KubeCon training tomorrow.
Yes, sir.
It's going to be a lot of fun. We get to see where we are on that. Keith, we're lucky to have you in, Melissa. Thank you for the work you do, and I'm trying to stay dry today.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, next item is consideration of agreement between Boost Together for Children and Story County for a continuation of the fiscal agent agreement effective July 1st, 18 through June 30 of 19. Mary, how are you doing today?
I'm good.
Morning, Mary.
Just for those in the audience that are not familiar with Boost Together for Children, we provide birth to five services in Boone and Story County, things like home visiting programs, like parents as teachers, preschool scholarships, et cetera, et cetera. And you also may not know that Story County serves as Boost's fiscal agent and my employer of record. And also, it happens that Laura serves on our board of directors. And to today's point, the county serves as our fiscal agent. It's a requirement, a state requirement, that each early childhood Iowa area have a fiscal agent. And ever since I've been here, and I've asked before that, Story County has served as a fiscal agent for this program. So at our board meeting last week, we voted to renew that agreement with Story County, and I know that you've been forwarded a PDF copy of that document. Along with that, I did put on each of your desks a snapshot from the last fiscal year, FY17. Our new fiscal year, or the current fiscal year, won't end until June 30th, and in a couple months later, we'll have another summary snapshot of that information, but it's not available yet. As far as what's going on and things I want to bring your attention to, I'm hearing more and more about the high cost and lack of availability of child care, especially in the Ames area. But I think we're seeing some trends statewide, maybe probably even nationally, that a number of home care providers are retiring, getting out of the business, and new people are not coming in at the same rate to take up the slack. And so we're just hearing that people are really having a struggle finding child care, and then also once they do, being able to afford that, to find it, you know, to make it fit within their budget. And there are many reasons for that, but we really want to dive into that and explore it at more depth. And so our board has agreed to work with the Iowa Women's Foundation to host a community conversation on July 18th at the Ames Public Library. And so I'll be sending out information to your supervisors and different your staff that are maybe connected with child care issues. And some of the other partners in that are the Chamber of Commerce. I appreciate that. United Way, the Child Care Resource and Referral Agency. So we want to try to get the usual suspects together, people with knowledge of this, but then also members of the public who maybe have been affected by child care shortages, and child care providers, and they could talk a little bit about the realities of maybe their guests or what kind of pressures they're under that may be prompting people to leave the field. So we'll be sending an invitation your way. So with that, I guess I would just finish by saying thank you. I've always said, and it still remains true, that we just get excellent services from your, especially we work most closely with your auditor's office in generating, well, first of all, my paycheck. And
that's important.
Our vendors here in the room, like we work with YSS, and they send an invoice to me, but Story County is the one that receives the funds from the state and disperses them. So I appreciate that.
So two quick thoughts, Marion. First of all, you're 100% right on child care, specifically infant child care in Story County. I mean, there's many anecdotal stories right now in Story County where a couple will find out they're pregnant and they'll go that day to get on a waiting list to try to have daycare availability. It's interesting to me because we've got so many, including, well, I see Dan Colhane in the audience, including our economic development and chamber folks who absolutely recognize that this is a an issue that we better be talking about in Ames and Story County. And so appreciate you guys really taking the lead on facilitating a piece of that conversation. It's important. Second thing I'd ask you to address, Marion, is what Story County receives for providing these fiscal agent services. So we started off at one level, kind of a market rate, and over the years, Story County has cut that back. But talk about that for just a minute.
Yes, the formula that we got for the fiscal agent services was 7% of my salary and benefits. And a couple years ago, when we received some cuts, or historically we've been level funded ever since I started, and then there were some tight budget years where we took mid-year cuts. And I am concerned, you know, even though it didn't happen this year, we were all expecting it with the budget shortfalls at the state level. So anyway, we came to Story County and said, things are tight. What can you do for us? And the Board of Supervisors agreed to reduce that percentage to, take one less overhead for our expenses.
Yeah, I think we reduced it to 3%, if I'm not mistaken.
Somewhere around
3%. Yeah, and 7% is kind of the going rate. If you go out and you get a fiscal agent, somebody to provide a service for a not-for-profit, it's kind of 7%. And so I'm proud that Story County stepped up and said, no, we're going to continue to look at Lisa Markley, if she's still in the room. We continue to provide the same great service. We just, a little less comes in for us providing that great service.
In addition, you also allow me to participate in your group insurance plan, and so I'm sure that's be much more expensive if we had to go out on the individual market if we could find insurance in the DC. But also what I think Story County gets is that we in turn take that money and put it straight back into things like preschool scholarships for low-income kids, home visiting programs, and I know that was behind your desire to lower those overhead costs, because I think that you feel confident that you know where the money's going, that it's going right back into.
Well, there's a definite benefit to Story County having a strong Boost Together for Children, no question about it. All right, board, questions about the continuation of our fiscal agent agreement? Marion, nothing different. You're not proposing anything different this year than we had last year.
The only thing that we hadn't updated, I'm sure Jerry has a comment at this point.
You going to sing for us, Jerry?
I'm so sorry.
It happens.
I realize my phone's on ring too, so I've so where was I? That
any changes?
That this agreement physically reflects the 3% that totaled the old agreement, and it did have provision that we could renew by just a letter of agreement, but since I wanted to update it to accurately reflect that 3% or whatever it actually is. It might be 3.something.
3%.
Okay. Yes. With that, that's the only change.
Two. Questions?
I want to make note that I abstained from the vote of the Boost Board about renewing the contract, because Story County would get the 3%. just, I don't. It's not directly financially beneficial to me, but I figured it'd be clean that way so I could vote this morning.
Nobody was going to accuse you of getting rich off that.
Yeah.
Okay. It is interesting that all the boards that we get to serve on, one of the common threads that lies right beneath the workforce is the fact that child care is such a pressing issue in this county. Mm-hmm. People always think that, well, with new industry, with new growth, that finding people to do the jobs is the biggest issue. Well, right beneath that is the families that come with the child needs. And I would look forward to hearing what you get out of that. I'm glad that somebody like yourself is looking into that, because clearly that I think that exists in so many communities here in Story County. Is that, I mean, Rick tells it best anecdotally. I remember when you said that last week. It's just like, it's true. When the moment comes in a young couple's life, they find they'll have a new mouth at the table. If they're not looking, they should be looking. And that's unfortunate that we find ourselves so far behind. And I know several providers that are just aging out, and they want to retire from that industry. And that's unfortunate because the need exists substantially. So whatever the Boost Board and Marion can do to affect a positive outcome, I look forward to it.
Okay.
Good luck.
I'm good. Thank you.
Make the motion.
Okay. I move that we renew the fiscal agent agreement with Boost for the fiscal year 19.
Second. Motion and second. Further discussion. Marion, anything to add? Thanks.
Thank you.
Holson.
Aye.
Keith.
Aye.
Sanders, aye. It's renewed. Marion, have a great day.
Yep.
Okay.
Next, discussion consideration of JCS, Juvenile Court Services, recommendation to transfer the final portion of dollars that the county has flowing through JCS to YSS. So we took this action. That was it 2 years ago? 3 years ago. We took this action 3 years ago with a different set of programs. And transfer it over. As far as I understand, it's been going really, really well, moving those dollars from JCS into the asset process and ultimately on to YSS. Anxious to hear about this recommendation today, Jerome.
Well, you've got a lot of it right there in your description.
Trying to set the table for wherever possible. Thank you for coming.
So, Rick, you're familiar, Beth's familiar, and Andrew, I thought, was up here.
Yeah.
Andrew's somewhat familiar. Deb was personally involved in this transaction or transfer when it happened 3 years ago. I approached Deb maybe a month ago and wanted to have a discussion on this. She obliged. And a week or two ago, I met with the three of us met and had a discussion on this. And came to the thought process of going through with assets. So that's where our discussion, our consideration comes forward today.
Perfect. Thank you. Deb, what can you tell us?
Just a couple of comments on this. So this was on the Board of Supervisors' agenda, actually found the agenda, on July 7th of 2015. So similar kind of request. Shirley Faircloth was representing Juvenile Court Services at the time, and George Belitzos Andrew was just getting new into his role at that time, that we came and talked about moving some of those services to the asset process. The total at that point in time was about $100,000 for those services. And the reason why we're looking at this to be effective July 1st of 2019, so it's into fiscal year 20, is because with the asset process, agencies will be turning budgets in September of 2018 to prepare for fiscal year 20. So we wanted to have this discussion, have the board address this in preparation for that part of the asset process that will start in September. The services that are listed here are all services that are currently in the asset process. So they're funded by City of Ames, currently funded by the City of Ames, some of them by ISU and United Way. So they're things that we can certainly take a look at in the current structure of asset. With that, I'll turn it over to Andrew.
How many dollars? What kind of dollars are we talking about?
It's current for fiscal year 19. It is a little over about $175,000 for fiscal year 19, so that could could bump up a little bit then by 20.
Mm-hmm. Well, but it hadn't bumped up. I mean, so that's one of the issues that I've had
when we moved the roughly 90,000 over from JCS to the asset process. The reality is that 90,000 hadn't increased for a few years. It was a true pass-through fund where the county was sending the money to JCS. JCS had a contract to send it on to YSS, and it had really remained stagnant. And I don't have those numbers in front of me, but it really remained stagnant. And the county had been increasing its at, well, the county has increased asset funding over the last 8 years by 94%. I mean, we almost doubled over 8 years, right? And that was after years of stagnation before that, where the county was not able to go up. But I got to look at this, and I said, well, in these programs, we're not able to do that, right? It's staying flat. And I have the same feeling about this. Andrew, I would expect, and we'll come to you, that there's a little trepidation because you know what you got right now, right? A bird in the hand kind of thing. You know what it is. It's pretty reliable. You don't have to go through the asset process for it, even though you're already in the asset process for these programs. But the upside to you is the potential to share in the growth, assuming the county is going to continue to grow as we have been while we're funding an asset. You want to address that?
Yeah, it's from an operational standpoint. I get this, you know. I think operational effectiveness and efficiency is something that we're all looking for. You're right. These were services, based on my understanding, that the county identified as needs.
Mm-hmm.
YSS stepped up, has been taking care of them. It feels like you lose a little bit of the control by shifting the process to asset. So there's some fear there. Having said that, you know, you stood by your word as it relates to this as a change in process, not a change in funding 3 years ago. I support the movement in that direction. We sure hope that we see growth in the funding, but also just appreciate that you keep your finger on how the funding process is going, what the needs are, and the fact that we continue to face, you know, headwinds as it relates to increased costs and also increased needs. So I support it.
Do we anticipate that there will be an increase in the number of juveniles needing it, or an increase in the cost per juvenile headed forward as we might increase our funding to the program? How does YSS, how do you see using that based on asset is definitely a fee-for-service program too?
I guess it would depend upon the service specifically, Loris, and also the need that exists. Some of these things are cost per unit where they're pretty fixed. Others are based on scale, right? If we get more kids, it's going to be less of a cost per unit of service.
I think the answer to your question is both.
Yeah.
Okay. It'll affect both.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it gives us more flexibility to deal with that if we are the ones funding it directly through asset. But let's be clear on what we're talking about. The Board of Supervisors, while we ultimately approve all the funding recommendations that come out of asset, it is really our asset team collectively that puts that together. Now, the arrangement that we made, and Deb, I'm going to ask if you help me with statistics here, but the arrangement that we made 3 years ago was, I believe we said to YSS, then George with Andrew just coming on board at that point, is we will commit that the funding will remain at least the same for 3 years. And then it's really in the asset process doing what it does. Is that accurate? Is that what we said?
We said
I don't think there was the 3 years.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, I think it was.
Well, we're not going to, I mean, you look at it, we're not going to go down, but you can't commit in perpetuity that you're going to fund something at a certain level forever and ever, right?
Right. And I think where the time frame came in was we want to try that first set of services first and see how that goes. And then we'll look at the rest of the services and see about putting those into the process. And that's kind of where we're at as far as being at the table today. I did look at figures just from the county for all YSS services from fiscal year 18 going into 19. And the county has an 8.25% increase to YSS for all of their services.
And that's with we were 5% overall that we increased.
Correct.
So YSS took more than the average if we only increased by 5% overall.
Correct, yeah. So, you know, I do think there is that good faith effort in terms of the assets volunteers and looking at the services and all the information, because I know there's a lot of information that YSS and the agencies have to provide to the volunteers to get to the recommendations that, that move on to the governing bodies.
Well, I've always said, in YSS, you guys ought to love a competitive environment, because you win every single time that I've seen in a competitive environment. The job you guys do, the services that you provide, is second to none. And so the idea, I get why the program started this way. The county identified some needs. The easiest way to make sure we were getting it funded was to funnel the money through JCS and let JCS handle the contract. But we're in a different spot now. Right, JCS's priorities have shifted. The way you guys operated, how streamlined you are, has shifted. Our asset process is as robust as anything anywhere in the state, and it just makes sense to me that that's where we'd be in this. And I think it gives us more room for growth, not less.
Now, I also see here there's a recommendation for the Iowa Department of Public Health substance abuse grant. To go to, when it says to be included in Story County's countywide budget, are you looking at them handling that the same way? Are you recommending those monies would go through into asset also? No. Okay, thank you. Oh, I see Lisa Hartley joined us.
All right. Might as well. So I guess before my time, which was a long time ago, the substance abuse grant was run through juvenile court's budget. Okay. I don't really know why. It's a $10,000 grant. YSS actually provides me with the information. I upload it. I get the money. I pass it back to YSS. So it's another pass-through situation. But that substance abuse grant has always just settled in there. It's been sitting in their budget.
Who applies for it? Is the grant directly to YSS?
Come on, Jerry.
Yeah. You're just get close enough so we pick you. Put your phone on vibrate.
Every county gets up to $10,000 of the substance abuse money. It's from Sunday sales tax. And as long as I've been here a long time, too.
You've been here longer than me, I think.
Okay. By soon to be 18 years, we've always gotten it in Story County. Now, it's been more competitive in other counties, but, you know, I write the grant, we self-close it.
Okay.
So
you guys approve it. It just has run through their budget. So basically what we're saying in this situation is, you know what, that's all fine and good that it runs through. It doesn't really matter which budget it runs through. It's going to be the same type of situation, but if it's in countywide, it's just not in the juvenile court budget.
And the reason I'm asking is I sit on a board of another agency where the grant money comes directly to the agency. And so I was wondering how the government got involved.
Has to apply for this one.
This is a particular thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Because that's one. Thank you very much.
So the only thing left, basically, in the juvenile court budget is going to be care, central protective living. That's all that's going to be left, which when we talk about budgets, we know that we're going to pay whatever we need to pay for that. So
yeah, we make an estimate.
We make an estimate and hope for the best.
Any other questions?
I'm good. Thank you.
Cheryl and I had a chance to talk about this earlier. Obviously, the history on this was it was going to come to this at some point. We're here. And I get the trepidation Andrew's got as far as stepping into the asset process for application of funds. But I think you're seeing the history here as we find it. And I think, you know, with some reasonable continuity that you can expect to be rewarded for being in that process.
So. Absolutely. But it's important to underscore these are all services that are already in the asset process. They just aren't funded by Story County right now. They're funded by Ames and United Way right now. And maybe, I don't know if student government funds a portion of these or not. So it'll be the same application. There just now is going to be a column under Story County where dollars will follow for those same services.
Yeah, you bet. We support it. The fear, again, is You know, the direct contact with the county through the asset process, ensuring that the asset volunteers understand that this was not an increase in the funding for a specific program. Absolutely. Year over year. It might look like there's an extra $175,000 being recommended when, in fact, it's lower dollars. And again, we did this 3 years ago, 2 years ago, and it worked okay.
And, Andrew, you bring up a really good point, because there'll be some re-educating, I think, that needs to be done, not only with the asset administrative team, but with the volunteers, because we have new volunteers and we did, you know, from years past. So we'll make sure and get that information out there so they understand why it's being added into the process and how that will work out. Yeah. So definitely.
My responsibility is I'm asking for a change, but I support all these funded programs.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, they're important to JCS. I mean, these exactly. programs are important to JCS.
Yeah. Yeah.
And other than the Protective Care program, they're all voluntary programs, correct? Am I correct in that? I mean, they're voluntary services?
Yes.
As far as what is legally mandated that a juvenile court provides?
Yes, okay. Every one of them.
All right. Thank you.
All right, if there's no other questions, I take a motion.
We'll move. Consideration of the Juvenile Court Services recommendation to transfer a portion of the YSS services funding to the FY20 asset process.
I would second.
Motion to second. Further discussion. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Chief.
Aye.
Olson.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. It passes. A reminder, this is for the FY20 budget, so these are the budgets that are coming in September for assets to review for FY20.
That's not. Yes, it's the same. Okay, it's not. What was it?
Now we'll continue with our annual report from YSS. Andrew, you're going to start, and then you're going to kick it off the staff.
Yeah, that's okay. I just want to thank you again for the support. I think, you know, whether it's through asset directly or for a special project, there's probably just no county better to be a kid in the state of Iowa than Story County. I know, you know, obviously born and raised here myself and benefited from a lot of the services, but the programs, the offerings are rich, and a lot of that has to do with your support of them. And the fact that YSS is based here. So you guys know all about the organization, but it's a 42-year history. I'm amazed every time that I see the statistic. We open up 7,000 individual case files a year on kids, upwards of 30,000 kids exposed through our prevention program and things like Teens Against Human Trafficking. And we ebb and flow just based on the time of year between 350 and 400 employees. So you think about just from an employer standpoint, and you don't oftentimes think about the impact of a nonprofit on the business climate or the sector as a whole, but I'm telling you that YSS, we've got a $20 million impact, and the majority of it centered right here in Story County. My focus is really on kind of the administrative backbone. I've got like an awesome team that you're going to hear from that are in the trenches every day providing the services to the kids. And if I think about where I can add value, it's in ensuring that we've got great financial systems, that we've got great HR, that we've got great technology, that we've got great quality assurance and strategic planning and fundraising and marketing and communications. If we've got those great core administrative functions, then these guys can go out and deliver a fantastic service. Most proud probably of this last year of receiving a 3-year CARF accreditation. So nonprofits probably 10 or 15 years ago started to think about how can they professionalize and how can they take their credentials to the next level. YSS was one of the first organizations that stepped up to the plate. It took a lot of work. It still continues to take a lot of work, but we know we're better because of it, and received just a few months ago the 3-year accreditation. Our strategic planning process, and again, that's a big focus of mine. We used to have a binder like this that we sent to asset. It was maybe bigger than that. I think Jean Cressy at United Way said, stop. They asked for the strategic plan. She said, stop sending the binder. And so we did take a new approach to our strategic planning process, and today the strategic plan for our organization is one page front and back. So are there more details to it? You bet. But can you get a sense for where we're going off this one page? You can. We start with our core values: commitment, compassion, integrity, collaboration, innovation, and the can-do spirit. You know, the reason that I get out of bed every day is not to go to meetings or present to the Board of Supervisors. It's about impact. So our mission is to create hope and opportunity by putting kids first.
We've got a five-year target, so some things specifically around health, around self-sufficiency, around education. We've got a big, hairy, audacious goal around financial self-sufficiency. So can we do something to create income so that I don't have to come here, you know, every year and beg for more money, but instead, you know, have a sustainable business model that will actually support some of the services and the growth of our work? I think that we can. We're always going to need your help, but I think that there's a business model that gives us the opportunity to provide more funding to support the services. So I've got a five-year target. I've got a three-year picture. I've got a one-year plan. And then I've got quarterly rocks. They're just goals or objectives. We break them up every quarter. We come back together, and we set rocks to be sure that we're getting the one-year plan done. So this is our strategic plan. This is what we're working off of. We've got some big goals for next year around, you know, development for our staff, around a facilities master plan, comprehensive fundraising, and then really some things around employment and people. Let me just say that we are facing some headwinds. I think that you probably hear about this a lot, but financial headwinds, low reimbursements on the contracts. We signed a contract, contracts with the state of Iowa a year and a half ago to provide a service for less than they're going to pay us. Almost $100 per day per kid in some of our shelter settings. So we're reimbursed just over $100 from the state. You come in with another $40. In some instances, it's $250 a day to provide the services, these services to a kid. So I've got to raise $100 per day per kid to continue some of these things. In addition, these contracts have required more staff support, more intervention, more work, and so essentially less dollars to continue to do more. But it is our mission, and we'll continue to do it. The Medicaid situation is not good for us. We continue to be denied the opportunity to provide services to kids in certain instances. We get the runaround as it relates to reimbursements. We were taking a look at the reimbursement for substance abuse treatment. It runs between $130 and $103 a day. Our cost is $185 a day. And we think the reimbursements are similar or maybe even the same as when I was in treatment 23 years ago. So, again, just 6 times less than a reimbursement from a private insurance commercial carrier, 6 times less. But we know that that's the population we've got to continue to serve, but we've got to have some sort of a balance. Increased health insurance costs in my first 2 years of renewals were up $700,000. So you think, I mean, we're not a huge agency. We would love to participate in your plan if you're, you know, I know Marion gets a piece of that, but $20 million organization, a $700,000 increase, $1.5 million. Going to just health insurance costs, and that's not even for all of our employees. That's just for the ones that are electing it, and their premiums are high, and the out-of-pocket expense is great. And then we've got, you know, quite a few deferred maintenance on our facilities. YSS has been just really great stewards of this community's resources. But we've essentially put kids in old houses, and that's a great environment because it feels like home, but it's not a durable environment that is conducive to providing the type of support that they need. And workforce, like everybody, is an issue. Hiring employees is tough. Keeping employees is tough. I lost a controller and a CFO back-to-back at the start of this year, both taking higher-paying jobs. Our direct service staff are in really tough positions and not making enough money to sustain that work long-term. There's obviously a lack of mental health professionals in this community. We do a decent job at recruiting folks out of school, but essentially you're in a provisional or a temporary license for 2 years. So we're a training ground. We spend 600 hours per year per employee in order to train them up to get them fully licensed, and the majority of them then go somewhere else. And so we're working hard on trying to create an environment where we can keep these folks, but then also, you know, maybe have some teeth to keep them for an extended period of time after they've got their license. And then we need psychiatry, and we really need adolescent psychiatry. Okay, so Mary Greeley's been trying to hire someone for a while. They've had several leads. They keep falling through. We need
adolescent psychiatry in this community. Right now we're using telehealth and have been for quite a while. We do that in a fairly effective way, but it's just not the same as having someone locally. So I would advocate on behalf of the county to continue to think about how they can bring mental health resources, including this focus on adolescent psychiatry here locally. Mental health needs continue to increase. You'll see that in the report from Kathy. We've got charts with the arrows going straight up. There's 6,000 kids in the state of Iowa 2 years ago that needed substance abuse treatment and didn't get it. So Loris knows about this. Our programs are full. We continue to expand, hoping to address and stay in front of the opioid epidemic, but we know that there are issues. Let me give you a quick update on YSS recovery centers. I spent a lot of time in these rooms a year and a half ago only to get your full support and approval, only to have a lawsuit levied against the county. What that did for us is it put us on our heels a little bit, and we shifted our focus to North Iowa, guys. We merged with an agency in Mason City. There's a need that exists up there, and so that's where our focus has been. We opened up a brand new adolescent addictions treatment program in February alongside the governor, and we're serving kids up there. We're going to come back to this not just community but location. I know that we've got a lawsuit or a trial date set in July. We're reevaluating what our needs are. I still want the option to buy that property. I still think it would be a good space for our program. Having said that, we've done some reevaluation as it relates to the overall program, one of which is, given the delay, we've got to do shelter now. So the shelter that we've got, the first shelter in the state of Iowa, again, is in an old house. And we've got a policy, the state's required us to have a policy of no eject, no reject. So we can't pick the kids that we take. We've got to take them all. And oftentimes these kids have, significant mental health needs, intellectual disabilities, and taking care of them in an old house, while it feels homey sometimes, is not the right tool for the job. And so when we come back to you and give you an update, the vision is a campus location that includes both residential substance abuse treatment and shelter. And we want to talk about this this opportunity around crisis intervention and stabilization. So you're just doing it, you're funding it for adults. That's great. What about kids? Kids are in similar situations regularly, and so we no longer have an adolescent psychiatric unit at Murray Greeley, and these kids are being brought to our shelter, again, without the tools to serve them appropriately. And so we look forward to the work group that the governor's putting together. We think that there was significant progress made for adults this year, but we've got to focus on kids, because if you don't help them now, if you didn't help me when I was 17 and a half, you're going to have to pay to keep me in jail later. So that's coming. The last thing I'll just say is I'm so proud of our people. We are doing an annual employee opinion survey every year. And this is the first year that we've got kind of comparables from year to year. But the most important things for our employees in order, probably 20 things to pick from, is number one, it's making a noticeable difference. Number two, it's the culture in their primary work area. Number three is salary. Number four is flexibility. We start employees with 4.5 weeks of vacation, guys. So 35 open positions come to work for YSS. Number five is mission. And the two things that I'm most proud of, 91% agree or strongly agree that they know how their role aligns with the strategic goals of the organization. I just love that. At Principal, when I worked there, it was like 40% knew how what they did contributed to the overall strategic plan. And 88% say that YSS is a great place to work. The last thing that I'll do is just say I provided you our impact report. I provided you with a one-pager as it relates to our core values, our mission and vision, and then a letter about a kid named Max. And Max sat in these chairs three times a year and a half ago talking to you about his story of getting adolescent substance abuse treatment, advocating on behalf of this vision for YSS recovery centers. He graduated our program. We wrote about him in this letter and told his story. And a first happened a month ago, and I opened my mail, and I got an invitation to this kid's high school graduation. Right, so how proud am I of the work that the staff are doing, of the lives that they're transforming, the kids going to UNI, and I just couldn't be any more excited for him, but also know that he's just one of 7,000. So that's probably longer than I should have taken. But let me turn it over to Jerry. So essentially, we work in three main areas: the prevention, which is Jerry's area, community, youth, and family development, transitional services, which Julia's going to talk about, and then Kathy's going to touch on treatment real quick.
Super. So before we get to that, just a couple things. First of all, I think it's important to note you started off with this as a top, but I've heard you say on multiple occasions YSS was a big part of saving your life and a big part of you becoming what you become, and I just think it's phenomenal to have you running the agency that had such an impact on your life. Second thing is, Story County, long before any of the three of us set up here, Story County has been a huge supporter of the work that YSS has done through the years, but there is no way that Story County will ever put as much into YSS as our community gets back from YSS. So you're going to be commended there. And then the third thing is a question, and it may not be for you, Andrew, but I'm going to ask it now, and maybe somebody can answer it for me as you're up. I'd just like an update. So you guys got the grant on the Children's Wellbeing Collaborative and trying to start to pull together. I'd like an update on that because I think the grant ends at the end of the month, and I'd like to know what's going on there. So thank you, Andrew. Other questions for Andrew before we move to Jerry?
Okay. Andrew, 7,000 cases opened every year. Are some of those repetitive from the year before?
Some are definitely repetitive from the year before, and some may even be engaged in more than one service.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. All right. Now, I'm going to give you just a little update because I knew you were coming today, so I asked our legal staff if they knew anything more about the situation out there with the conditional use permit. Okay. I think you got a trial date of September now.
Oh.
I'm sorry to bring that to you. They have that perspective.
And Jerry might know this, but at the point that the lawsuit took place, I was under the impression that they had 18 months to take it to trial. So I assume that they can do a continuation and get it extended beyond 18 months. But in my mind, it was 18 months, and it was March of 2017.
Just reading off of what came to me, it was it's court docket time.
Okay.
All right. I just thought I'd let you know,
because
I knew you were coming. So.
Thanks.
Anything else?
No, other than that, well, thank you again for what you do, and I continue to feel privileged to go to the Juvenile Justice Committee in the most months and hear what's happening and what's happening on the ground and all the challenges you do face.
Anything for Andrew, or you save it as we hear from staff?
I was going to say, just on a topical overview, it's just shocking and sobering to see the burn rate you do on dollars just to maintain delivery of services and continuity of operations. And Mary, you probably shouldn't let the cat out of the bag on health services.
Right, I was going to say 3%. Well, health is and 3%.
Yeah, I was going to tell you, we're by the time we're all in, we're probably close to $3 million that we spend here in Story County, 2.3, I think, directly on health insurance. And we've gone up, Alyssa, we've gone up over $1 million in the last 4 years when we made the transition. Now we're providing it. So we're all feeling the pain of trying to provide health insurance for our staff.
Well, a good deal was 20% increase instead of a 30% increase.
Yeah, that is scary.
Yeah, 46% was a $300,000 increase. The next year it was down to 24%. It was $300,000 again, though, because it's $300,000.
Jerry, we won't talk any more health insurance.
Okay.
I'll address your children's well-being.
Thank you.
I got the privilege of managing that. We received the grant in November. It was a 8-month, 7-month grant. Our charge was to pull together a collaboration, and we pinpointed early childhood, so 0 to 8, and the counties we chose were Boone, Story, Marshall, Hardin, Hamilton, and Franklin, so part of our mental health region. We decided we could not handle all of it. We've had great participation from every county. We brought them together 3 times to help plan, and our steering committee met last week and talking about how we can keep those core people going in each community. Some of our tasks were to pilot a family development assessment tool to look at some type of prevention, and I think Jane was going to talk a little bit about that when she talks substance abuse prevention, to... I'm going to lose the next one. Because, and publicity, to get the stigmatism out of mental health, and we chose to partner with Prevent Child Abuse Iowa, who had some professionals drafting up the information, and unfortunately we don't have that yet. So we will get that out to agencies and communities as we get that. Because we were emphasizing early childhood, we also chose to pilot a ages and stages social emotional tool. So we piloted two tools, which are we're wrapping that up. We also, one of the big issues was, how do we know what services there are? So we took the lead and started pushing 211. Remember, 211 has a bad rap. They've come up with new software. And so when we gathered these folks together, many of them had never even heard of 211. It's a nationwide system to find resources that you need. So we've really been pushing it out. And as a result, the other two agencies that got that collaborative grant are doing the same. So they followed our lead. So there's a big push to get that information out. Am I missing anything? And of those of you who are on our steering committee, okay. There's another round of grants coming out, and we're going to try for that to continue it. And we're also exploring a SAMHSA grant to try to keep it going also. So.
I know that I had kind of offered a location, okay, and to buy the water, all right, for the next kind of getting everyone together.
Oh, okay.
We have a steering committee. I did that at the last meeting.
Okay.
So when I kindly asked Carla, thank you very much. Carla Webb and Deb were kind of coordinating that, and I appreciate how much they have addressed one of my concerns walking away from that, is how do we assure that everybody in Story County's services are listed, just not the core
right.
steering committee, and they're up to date, you know, the churches and everything. Okay, and so anyway, I assume that the steering committee, Carla, didn't you say the steering committee met? Yeah, on that. So I, as a sole supervisor, okay, and I'm certainly interested at looking at if the grants don't cover going forward, some way to make sure that the information in the system is current, that different ways to go about that. So I know. I'll turn it over to you, Carla.
Sure. At our steering committee meeting last week, I believe it was, we talked about next steps for getting the anti-stigma information out there, the 211 information out there. And the plan is the steering committee information on all the participants that attended the collaborative meetings. There's a contact person for each county. So the information on all the participants is going to be sent to that contact person. And then it's really going to be left up to each county on pulling folks together and then developing that plan on how do we get that anti-stigma information out, how do we get 211 updated. I've certainly been sharing out the 211 update information to contacts that I have. So it is farther reaching than... I would say our provider agencies in that. So, it'll be a project certainly to do that.
Thank you for that.
Some very committed people.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay.
I'm going to let Laura Bell, who is our manager for Eastern Story County, talk about her services.
Hi, Laura Bell.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. I know it's been, we've been here a while, so I'll keep it short. I just want to highlight three things. Recently, we made a city council convene a community conversation on substance abuse to talk about the opioid crisis and kind of get ahead of the issues that are hopefully not going to come to us, but eventually probably will. But also there is, current substance abuse issues in Eastern Story County and throughout Story County also. Out of that, YSS and then other partner agencies, were part of the conversation. And so since that time, they've started a task force to address some of the issues and look at what can be done to, you know, start some preventative measures now within Eastern Story County and then also Story County in particular. And so myself and some other partner agencies are part of that task force. And so we're starting to look at what can we do to educate providers, what can we do to educate the community, and what can we do to increase those risk and those protective factors to counteract those risk factors available.
So with the mayor of Nevada, who is a pharmacist, I mean, this is right in his wheelhouse, mm-hmm. and I'm just appreciative that you guys are working with him to pull all that together here in Eastern Story. Yeah, but we're in a little bubble, but that doesn't mean we're going to be in a bubble forever.
Exactly. And then we also partnered with the Nevada Kiwanis Club to start up the backpack program again. So originally it was started to kind of make backpacks available to young people who were involved with like law enforcement calls and things of that nature to give them some sort of comfort and security. We've expanded that with them thanks to their partnership, and so they've given backpacks to our residential treatment programs to give, you know, school supplies to students who are returning home so that they have something to, you know, start off the school year clean, sober, and successful with, you know, supplies. But also too, they've really helped out a couple of our little ones in our kids club programs who each had a parent who is undergoing cancer treatment. And so then they're transitioning between parent and, you know, grandparent or other, you know, family homes while parents are in transition with their treatment. And so they have each been provided with backpacks that will give them, like, you know, toys and books and things, you know, that nature that they can take with them that they know that is theirs and gives them a little bit more secure security and comfort. And then finally, I'm kind of starting my own little tour of Story County. I've been meeting with school, you know, school representatives, and I'm also working on reaching out to different community stakeholders to really kind of get an understanding of assessment needs and issues within Story County, and in particular Eastern Story County, and kind of, you know, if we're not the provider for that, that's fine, but, you know, making sure that they're aware of what resources are available and how it can be a connection point for them.
Super. Very necessary. I mean, all of this really goes together. I was talking to the superintendent of Colonesco the other day, and talking about the services, not only the YSS provides, but Marion, going back to what you talked about and the idea of daycare in some of our smaller communities and the impact that can have across the board. So thank you for initiating those conversations, and enjoy your tour of Story County.
Okay. Well, Felicia's coming up to talk about mentoring our person who is now in charge of kids club, teen club, and summer enrichment is in programs right now and could not break away. But, you know, kids club is going well. We're still in the 6 sites, and you've got tons of information in this report. But probably the most shining moment for me for kids club this past 6 months is we lost our manager due to pregnancy and child care costs, and could not find a new person, struggled, and those 6 supervisors came together and managed it.
Wow.
It was just wonderful to see. We did promote somebody internally who was doing the teen club, which is solely funded by juvenile court dollars. That is one program. It falls under kids club, but it's all those dollars go to that program, and our summer enrichment program. So she is going to take over Kids Club. And summer enrichment is such a wonderful partnership for this county, bringing together schools, United Way, Mary Greeley, Story County Reads. And if you have a minute to volunteer to help serve lunch or breakfast at any of those sites, Ames, Nevada, or Collins Maxwell, please do. There's about 250 kids a day for that 6-week program. So Felicia Watkins has never been here before.
Felicia,
hi.
Good morning. We're scared.
And Felicia first came to us as our kids club manager and left, but came back as our mentoring manager. So I'll let you talk about mentoring.
So I don't know how familiar you are with the mentoring program, but we have a school-based program that's been running for 20 years. Just last year, we started a community-based program. The school-based program is in Ames, Ballard, Gilbert, Nevada, and then Collins Maxwell. Our community-based program is geared more towards our ISS, residential and treatment programs. Right now, that program has 8 matches, so that's really great. One match just celebrated 1 year together. That youth actually started off at Rosedale Shelter and then was able to transition to the transitional living program with their mentor alongside them back away. We checked in with that mentor, and they reported that that particular youth has improved, made significant improvements in just them as a person and really taking initiative. They meet monthly several times. They just really take the initiative to get to those meetings on their own. Our biggest challenge right now is just finding mentors. For Story County, we had 67 students on the waiting list at the end of the school year. I have seen an increase in males needing a mentor, specifically at the middle school level. I would say our biggest impact, despite the waiting list, is that we have thoughtfully matched youth in our program, and that can take some time. Just to give you some examples, at our Gilbert program, we matched a student that wants to be a police officer with a police officer in the community. For our AIMS program, we had a student that was showing little interest in school, but they're really smart and they enjoy math and science, and we were able to match that student with an Iowa State student working on the solar car project. So,
very.
I think that's it.
Outstanding. Thank you.
Felicia, before you go, you had on your outcome studies show that said the students who experienced the greatest difficulties also showed the greatest improvement. What is that?
Can you repeat that? I'm sorry.
This is just quoting you. The students who experienced the greatest difficulties also showed the greatest improvement. Is there some connection, cause, anybody want to buy into that?
Well, go ahead.
When you've got this far to go, right, as opposed to just this far, you're able to improve. Got the greatest amount of improvement. You've got the furthest to go. If that makes sense.
No, that's pretty straightforward.
Yep.
Thank you. Very good.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good job, Blake.
Well, James, coming up, a comment on child care. I started my career in Story County in child care, and even in the 80s, people were putting their names on lists as soon as they found out they were pregnant. So this is a long, long-term problem. Jane Larkin's been here before.
But before, to finish up on that, or tag into that earlier grant that we worked on.
Oh, children's well-being.
You know, I think one simple thing that as a participant of an asset that the Story County supervisors could recommend is that all funded agencies maybe just add a line to your report out. Have you, yes or no, updated your 2-on-1 information in the last 6 months to just assure that if you're paying out the money that they're participating in assistance kit out to the public, that they know those resources are out there.
Then you can take that suggestion to the asset management team to discuss. Thanks, Mary.
Thank you, Mary.
Hi
there.
Hello there. Jane Larkin. I'm the Community Prevention Manager. So I oversee the substance abuse prevention, the youth development, the youth employment, and the child abuse prevention. And so I'd like to start with the youth development programs that we have. And really, youth development is the foundation of the programs within YSS. So we've really looked to promote those youth and adult partnerships, those relationships. Because sometimes the students, the young people, just don't have that adult person in their life to be that role model for them. And so that's something that we really strive to do. I believe that's also part of the success of our mentoring program as well, too, providing those healthy relationships. This year we had a Risky Business Action Summit, so we've had Risky Business conferences the last 30 years. And we looked at that, we took a hard look, and we decided, hey, you know, we really want to concentrate on youth and adult partnerships, and what does that look like? And really to take this statewide. And so we had a summit where we invited youth and adult teams to come together to look at how to address issues that they identify in their community to to take some action on. And so we had 9 teams that came, youth and adults, 10 people per team, that were able to come together. They looked at how to develop an action plan, and we kept in contact with them throughout the rest of the school year. It was great to have that continued contact to help them brainstorm different gaps that they saw within the community, roadblocks that they came up against. And they had the support of the other teams, the youth and adult teams, throughout the state. Huh. So it was a great success.
Outstanding.
Yes. And so that is part of our youth development program. Youth employment is another strong program that we have. It is a staff member that works with young people to promote those work skills. Oftentimes we think, hey, they get that kind of service in the schools, but we found they may receive it in middle school, but the lessons that are learned there, they're not always coming to fruition for when they do go out into the community to have those jobs. And so a lot of what our prevention specialist does is that she'll work with the students one-on-one and identify specifically what are they interested in, and then to look in the community to see how can we connect that young person to that career, and to have them connect to talk with that professional to identify, okay, what do they need to do to help prepare themselves for that career. One great example is that we had a young lady who was interested in nursing, and through more conversation, she was interested in the birthing. And so we set her up with a doula, which is that natural childbirth. And so it was a great contact for that young person, and able to kind of further her career, further her interest within that possible career down the road. Mm-hmm. In this, we also really stress the importance of community networking, community outreach, connecting the youth within the community. And so that's a lot. We do volunteering. Volunteering is a lot of what we do with our youth employment program, because it's really on-the-job skills training for that. So that's another piece of what we do with our youth employment.
Jean, I'd like to ask about the comment under the trends section.
Yep.
For youth employment. When you're talking about going out to find the jobs that they want, it says they do not want traditional jobs. They want careers where they can set their own hours. And then it says that they seem to be unrealistic. Also, somewhere else is in the report about some don't think they're going to work. They're going to live on government aid. And so is that typical across the spectrum of the youth that your employment specialist is serving?
You know, it depends on the group that she's working with. A lot of this is reality checks, too. You know, looking at what career, what really interests you, and what type of career could come out of that, and helping them to connect those dots. Helping them to, that's why it's so important to connect with those professionals in the community so that they can have a realistic idea of what their future may hold, if that's something that they want to pursue. So, and it's really just having those open conversations with the youth, you know, what they think may just not be realistic. So,
all right, thanks.
I'm always tickled by that. So one of my early bosses told me, said, Rick, you can be successful, and all you got to do is work half days. And it doesn't even matter which 12 hours you work. If you just work half days.
See, it's all in how you do it.
There you go.
Exactly.
You might have to take that line back.
Exactly. And moving on to the child abuse prevention services. So this is, they're talking about touching programs that we do in the school districts, but it's also doing community presentations about what to look for child abuse concerns, the red flags that are out there. We know that we need to do a better job of getting that type of information out there to our community members. And so that is where we've really partnered closely with the Children's Well-Being Grants. So one of the things that Jerry had mentioned is that we provide a universal prevention program. And that program that the collaboration decided on was our Connections Matter training. So that is a presentation to do with community groups to identify the impact that an adult, a caring adult, can have on a young person's life, and how that connection can also impact brain development, can impact their physical health, and there's research behind this. It's an evidence-based program, and it's some great information. And we actually have a training coming up with an invitation for all of you if you would like to come. It will be June 27th from 9 o'clock until 12 o'clock, and then a preview of the documentary Resilience. And so it's really giving youth a voice is what we do with our Talking About Touching program, and letting them know that they have supports within their lives and who those supports are and how to take, how to ask for help, how to say no if they feel uncomfortable with something. So those are our child abuse prevention services. And then last, we have our substance abuse prevention services. We have two school-based programs, Too Good for Drugs and Project Alert. Too Good for Drugs is our elementary program, third, fourth, and in Nevada, fifth and sixth grade. And then we have our Project Alert program, which is our middle school substance abuse program. But what I'd really like to bring your attention to, I think it's been mentioned before, the opioid epidemic is within our state. We have gotten ahead of it. There was the opioid task force was created before we had some instruction from the state, and Kathy may be speaking about this later on, from our service providers to do a assessment of what is the opioid issue within Story County, Boone County. And so we identified that, you know, we're already ahead of this. Part of what we need to do is to work with first responders to do some naloxone training, which is the drug that can be given in an overdose to counteract the effects. And so there are two YSS staff who are trained to be able to provide that naloxone training, and then we also have some police officers who are also trained from Story County and Ames to be able to provide that service as well, too. And so that is one of the initiatives this next year we will be going. We're expanding that to beyond first responders to also groups that are interested in this. If they feel that they may come in contact with people who may, they may need this resource. And so that's going to be the focus coming up.
Who is the we? YSS or the opioid task?
Opioid task. Yeah.
Okay, thank
yep.
you.
Yep,
opioid task.
Yep. Sorry, we're a member of that, so...
Thank you.
But we also want to remind people that alcohol continues to be the number one drug abused in Story County and across the state. We tend to lose focus of what's trending, what's the new drugs coming in, but alcohol continues to be the number one drug being abused, followed right behind by marijuana. We have done a great job of reducing those rates, as you can see with the Iowa Youth Survey. Those are in the report here, too, that those numbers have gone down as well, too. But we always want to remember that alcohol and marijuana continue to be the number one drugs of abuse. So even when we do our opioid trainings, we also talk about that.
Absolutely.
So, and those are the four programs I have.
Super. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
I'm going to turn it over.
Are you okay?
Next.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Julia Webb. I'm the director for CWS and day programs at YSS. So I oversee our Rosedale shelter here in Story County, and then I also oversee some programs up in our North Iowa location in Mason City. I will keep this very brief out of respect for everyone's time, but just want to highlight a couple of things. Andrew noted that July 1st of last year, we procured and signed a contract to deliver child welfare emergency services again. It's a contract that we've had for years and years, but there was a statewide procurement a year and a half ago, and then we were able to sign on for 8 guaranteed beds, which was a decrease from 10.47 beds the 5 years prior. So at Rosedale, we are continuing to offer that emergency shelter care service as well as other diversion services, trying to keep kids out of shelter. But what I want to draw your attention to is the couple of trends in that contract, as Andrew kind of highlighted, that are asking us to do more with less. The first one is a trend to keep kids in home, and so while there are many in-home providers across the state doing different kinds of work, behavioral skills counseling, that kind of thing, in homes, child welfare emergency services or CWS providers, shelter providers, are being asked to offer 24-hour
crisis lines where we can intervene with a family in crisis. So this is, you know, Mom and Johnny got in a fight at home. It's 11 o'clock on a Tuesday night. They may call Surrey County Sheriff or the local PD, but oftentimes families are a little hesitant to get police involved. And so we operate a crisis line for them to call us, and we'll start with sort of telephonic crisis intervention. So having skilled, trained staff to intervene over the phone, and then may actually dispatch a staff member to go out to the home and try to do some mediation in the home. And then also up to a 47-hour stay in shelter. So if things can't resolve, either, you know, verbally de-escalating, then we'll bring the child into shelter for up to 2 nights. While we kind of get some services in place, everybody cools down, and then we'll facilitate that mediation at shelter, or take the child home and do it in the home, putting in place a safety crisis prevention plan, and making referrals to outpatient services. So that piece of what we do, when you think about shelter, you don't think about the diversion services that we offer, but that's been a huge increasing piece of what we do. And then the other piece that is a shift for us is the shift to what the state is calling the one caseworker model. All of the state contracts in foster care, as well as foster group care services, and in child welfare emergency services, are now being asked to have one caseworker for each kid. So when I first started 5 years ago, I asked the question, why don't we have caseworker? Why don't we have case managers in shelter? And the state really clearly responded back to me and said, you're not supposed to do that. That's not your role in the larger child welfare system. Your role is to house those kids for the short duration of time that they're there, but coordinating and facilitating other services is really the role of the DHS worker at the state level or the juvenile court officer. But I really felt like that wasn't great practice to not have one point of contact communicating with that kid, making sure that the child knows what's going on with their transition plan. And so I developed a position that was called the client services specialist. We weren't technically caseworkers, but really managing the case file and helping be a point of contact at shelter for those for all of the parties involved in that youth's life. This year, the contracts demanded we have a caseworker for each kid. And so that position evolved into the caseworker role. And now our caseworkers work in collaboration with a juvenile court officer or a DHS worker, or in the case where DHS or JCS is not involved with the family, work in collaboration with the parents, therapists, other providers, to facilitate and coordinate care for the youth that are placed in shelter. So it really has elevated the level of service that we're providing in shelter. For those kids that are court ordered or are staying in shelter for any duration of time, but notably did not come with an increase in rates as we started to deliver that. So those are kind of the two big trends for us. You can look through and see in the report, you know, other things that we're doing and some of our data, but just wanted to highlight those two things.
Perfect. Thank you.
I do have one question.
Sure.
As related back to something Andrew said earlier, just about congratulations on the diversion part of that, okay? Because you show 49 clients served in shelter, and then the 68 diverted. But Andrew had referenced that some clients could be $250 a day, but we're only paying like getting $3 plus the 40 we give. Are those the numbers that are applicable for you for the $100 a day per client still that YSS is having to come up with the numbers somewhere else?
Yeah, so we get reimbursed by the state and county $148.48.
Okay.
$148.48, or about $150 if you'll round with me. Across the state, they ask us to do, the department asks us to do a cost report to say how much it costs us to actually deliver those services. And our cost report has run in the 5 years I've been here from between both shelters from $136 5 years ago to up to $250. So any kid that stays there for a night
given we're operating a 24-hour crisis line, I've got, you know, staff at a ratio. The state says we have to be at a ratio of 1 to 5. I'm operating at a ratio of 1 to 3 because of the acuity of the needs of the kids. And then delivering that elevated service. If the child comes into shelter, that's that to what Andrew was referencing, that's the per kid per night. The diversion costs are a little bit more difficult to figure out. The actual cost of sending a staff member out, I mean, keep in mind that that ratio is now 1 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
But we're really, because that's such a new service for us, we haven't really broken down for us what are the costs of delivering that service. And also, the number of children that we have served is doubling year over year for that service. So that's been a little bit. When I was first here 4 years ago, we served about 20 kids in diversion. 2 years ago, it was, you know, and now we're up to what, almost 70, I think, by the end of the...
Thank you for that, because I was trying to do the math for all of them in the head, thinking you guys are really taking in this particular just area itself.
Yep.
But again, thank you.
You bet. Good. Thank you.
I will hurry. Kathy Dingus, I took the clinical director job with YSS for their outpatient services about 18 months ago. Last time I spoke here, I was with a different agency, so this is nice for me. Since I started with YSS, we have made a concerted effort across our outpatient areas, all of our outpatient areas, but specifically in Story County, to improve our intake process and the rapidity that we're able to serve clients. Early last year, we were looking at probably 2 to 3 weeks turnaround to get a new person on board with therapy services in the clinic, and today we are somewhere between 24 and 72 hours. We are also looking in the coming year at implementing some crisis scheduling where we will have reserved hours available for anybody walking in the clinic, being referred from the county, from the hospital, and I'm really excited to get that in place. I think that is a huge need, especially with the closing of the adolescent unit at Mary Greeley. It gives us an opportunity to do early intervention services with folks, and quite often things can be diverted and don't need to end up in hospitalization if you have the right person there at the right time. So we're very happy about that. Not intending to expand services in Story County, we have seen a slight increase in spite of really not anticipating that or working toward it. I think it's the efficiency that we're able to see folks. I think we are developing some expanded kinds of therapy interventions that are very appealing to the community with our play therapy education component that we have and the expansion of those services. We are also expanding substance abuse at this time. In the past, YSS notoriously had primarily substance abuse in their outpatient clinic. Over the years, that has dissipated with more individuals being treated for co-occurring disorders, because we recognize that most individuals have both disorders, but we are refocusing on expanding substance alone services and have implemented the intensive outpatient program in March of this year, and we have also expanded the number of individuals we have who are able to provide standalone substance abuse services. In February, we partnered with ISU and have a YSS substance abuse professional on campus one day of the week. So overall, services are really going great. We also have implemented a special group treatment program in the outpatient clinic for adults and for adolescents with emotional dysregulation. So those are the things that we've done this year, and growing really exponentially in other areas as well.
Well, congratulations on reducing the intake process. So, I mean, from 2 weeks to 24 to 72 hours is amazing. Mm-hmm. And to me, anecdotally anyway, that would help explain an uptick in mm-hmm. getting people through services, because there's got to be a loss factor if it's taking a while to get them in.
Exactly. Yeah. And our biggest challenge, as Andrew had said, was obtaining good professional therapists and retaining them in our service. That is it's really, really tough. We have the independent practitioners are just after our folks all the time.
Well, I'm hopeful that some of what Mary Greeley's doing, if they can go ahead and identify a couple of qualified individuals that they can get, that we're going to get a little more robust here in Story County and what's available.
Yeah, and all those supports make a difference.
Absolutely.
So, Kathy, I'd like to ask you about the demographics of people in the treatment services. So, as I read through the report, and you're talking about adults, then I do see age 18 to 26, the transition area. So are those the adults you're talking about giving your therapy to, or are you starting to give therapy beyond age 26?
In some cases we are, and my philosophy coming into the agency was not necessarily to change the approach for children, but to expand the connections that children have naturally. So we are treating extended families for individuals that we have coming in, and I personally have a specialty in geriatrics, and so we see a lot of grandparents who are now caretakers in the family and really need to have that support to continue with what they're doing. And so we're able to serve the entire family. And then in addition to that transitional age, which is enhanced by our agreements with ISU, mm-hmm. our work there.
Okay, thank you, because I assume you're still partnering with other agencies, and I wasn't quite clear. So you're doing family therapy. Mm-hmm. I believe I saw Jason Hagman do a presentation on that a couple of years ago. Okay, great. It looked like you really are delving in then. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely. We'll close where we started. YSS is such an important part of the fabric of Story County, and thank you to all of you and all your partners at YSS for the work you do for Story County. And Andrew, we sure appreciate everything you do. Let us know how we can be helpful. Thanks. All right, next item is consideration of minutes, and we've got June 5th, June 12th, and the primary election minutes from June 12th.
Move as presented.
Oh, I second.
Motion and a second. Chitty.
Aye.
Olson.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. I take care of all three of those personnel actions as listed.
Move as presented.
Second.
Olson.
Aye.
Chitty.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Consent agenda.
Yes. Presented.
Second.
Chitty.
Aye.
Olson.
Aye.
Sanders. We are moving now.
Yeah. Move.
All right. No public hearing items today for the first time in a few weeks. So we're additional items. Martley wants money. So we've got Resolution 18-119, Appropriations Amendment. And I think I can safely assume that this is the last one of the year for us.
This is the last
and then
amount of
start
money.
Start 2019, FY19, with one.
You'll see me at the end of next week because I'll have to get the money ready for the next fiscal year. But this is the last one for this fiscal year. This is, quite frankly, the last $82,000 that has not been appropriated in the overall budget.
So we're up to 100%
yep.
of what we budgeted
yep.
now that we're putting in.
And I just want to make sure I got it all appropriated because the requests for money are coming across my desk at rapid speed right now.
Any questions? If not, take a motion.
I would move that we approve this appropriations request as presented.
Second.
Motion and a second. Discussion? Great job, Lisa, as always. Olson.
Aye.
Chief.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Resolution 18-119 passes, and that is the final $82,000 to get us to 100% appropriation. Next is discussion consideration of restrictions on temporary structures and vendors along Story County Road right-of-way during RAGBRAI after what is now a 21-day review, since we missed our 14-day review window. So, Board, I don't know about you, but I got a couple calls and contacts right out of the gate, people worried that we were messing with RAGBRAI. And for me, in every case, once I explained exactly what we were talking about, we just don't want vendors in the road right away. So what I'm telling people is basically outer edge of roadside ditch or further away is appropriate. Anything inside that is not appropriate. Trying to maintain as much safety as we can in the road right away. And once I explained that to the people that contacted me, they said, oh, okay, well, that makes perfect sense. Anybody have a different experience than that?
No, it was very straightforward. I'm glad that you were getting those calls, because I think it's a very easy story to explain.
Mm-hmm. I had the same result. The conversation I had with a vendor who has done Red Rye for 20 some years, okay, who is a friend of mine in my cycling days, and he happens to sell tattoos, and we were discussing the situation. He thought we were very smart. And that was nice, because this man does not get compliments easily, okay. But so that was my
job. Somebody who sells roadside tattoos doesn't get compliments easily.
He has another job. He takes the day off. Right? He takes the time off for Red Rye, the state fair, and is more apparently doing that in those 3 weeks than he does as insurance salesman. But anyway, back to the affirmation for me then is when he said that this made a lot of sense, is that I thought, okay, this is a guy who really knows the serious Red Rye people. So with that, I would make a motion that we go ahead and accept it for final, as stated. Our policy was stated finally.
Second. All right, and let's just be as clear as we can be. The only thing we're taking action on is we're saying we're not going to have any roadside stands in the county right away. That's it. That's all we're talking about.
Yep. And roads. Yeah, and that includes the county
on the right away. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Anything further? No. Olson.
Aye.
Chee.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. That takes care of road right away during rag ride. Next is discussion and consideration of a replacement heat pump at our friend the Justice Center by Mechanical Comfort for $5,407. Joby, we're starting to see you a lot on the Justice Center. And it's
as much as I love seeing you guys every Tuesday.
I said the other day, and I absolutely believe this. Other than its conception, design, and construction, the Justice Center is a great building.
I would agree with that.
And now everybody needs to be aware of this. Over the next few years, we're going to spend over $1 million maintaining the Justice Center. It's a 16-year-old building. I mean, this is ridiculous. It's a 16-year-old building, and we're going to spend well over $1 million, I believe, in the next few years just to maintain it because it's not a great building.
It's not a great building, and like, here we are today with this one. The biggest problem with it is the manufacturer of these heat pumps has been sold, so, and the new company is no longer producing replacement parts. So I don't think you would pull out options other than to replace the whole unit. So.
Questions for this one? Pretty straightforward. We're going to spend $5,407 to replace a heat pump, and so going beyond what's on the agenda, we just better be aware that we're going to start seeing a lot of these. You want to give us a 30-second update on the roof over the Justice Center? So we had 300 leaks after the last hailstorm, or the first hailstorm, and then we got that down to about 20 now.
27 to be exact on last Friday, and then I haven't got the report of how many we had this morning.
This morning.
But we did have some. But
hopefully it's less than 27 this
time. I'm hoping so. I'm hopeful. But we're doing a reevaluation of it, hopefully.
Board, we've got a lot of work to do on the Justice Center. Today it's $5,400 for a heat pump.
So when you sit there and say you have you're leaking refrigerant, is that getting to the black hole? Is that getting in?
Yes. It is not doing harm to the well field, because given the size of the heat pump, Marty, it's less than a pound of refrigerant that is leaked out of the unit.
Okay, because we had that issue here on our well field. Yeah, the glycol well just completely degraded. Yeah, we had to change it all out.
Yes, this last fall we changed it all out.
Right. So if that's not the case, then
no.
This is housekeeping. We have to fix it. I foresee. I think the story is correct. It's a building that got built to a dollar. It was not built in the sense that it was just like holistic approach. Because if you look at our capital improvements plan, they're pay sizable. You know, to do what it should have been done 20 years ago.
Make a motion.
I would move that we move consideration of the replacement of the heat pump at the Justice Center by the Mechanical Comfort for $5,407.
I would second.
Motion and a second, and for anybody, Morris and Marty, for you, but for anybody else, if you want to hear some good stories about this building from conception all the way through to its construction, talk to former county attorney Stephen Holmes. He has a unique perspective, and he's been saying this for the last 15 years that we were going to get into this situation, and that's exactly where we are. Further discussion?
No. I want to thank Alyssa and Joby and John and your crew for keeping your good humor on this, because especially the rain was a rough part, and all of the things that are failing. So thank you, you guys.
You're welcome. It's unfortunate that we're having to task staff with. I mean, this building is all the building we're in right now. This was built in the 60s, right?
51-year-old.
Yeah. I mean, it's unfortunate that we're dealing with this 16-year-old building. So, Chi,
aye.
Olson,
aye.
Sanders, aye. Heat pump.
Thanks, Joby.
Yep.
Okay.
Next is discussion consideration of hazard mitigation plan strategies. Leanne.
Good morning. Officially,
huh? I just
Just before the end starts, are we keeping a running total of the dollars that we are spending on that building?
Yeah, I mean, we're at the beginning of it.
Well, I mean, if we chase down these tailing units, I mean, are we keeping, as somebody can sit and say, we spent X amount of dollars?
Yes. Lisa Martin.
Thank you.
Okay. What is before you this morning is really seeking some guidance. I'll be back next week for the final action, not only final action, for official action. But as Keith mentioned in his report, Story County and all the jurisdictions are currently updating multi-jurisdictional, multi-hazard mitigation plan. We're working with a consultant. I am the board's representative on the planning committee, the Hazard Mitigation Planning Committee. What I'm going to do is just go over a couple slides on the risk assessment. And then I really want to just go over the mitigation strategies, and I'll try to be brief, but I do need to spend a little bit of time.
Yeah, do what you got to do. Absolutely.
The risk assessment is 80-some, 90-some pages, maybe actually 120 pages, I should say. This is the part of the plan that identifies the hazards, and then the through a variety of scoring mechanisms, what are the highest hazards at Story County and all the various jurisdictions within Story County face. Specific for the unincorporated areas of Story County, which is what we are discussing today, only unincorporated areas of Story County, the five highest ranking hazards that Story County faces are river flood, tornado slash windstorm, flash flood, severe windstorm, and hazardous materials. And then it goes down the ranking through the medium and the low. I want to just know that these are important because that is where generally the hazard mitigation strategies themselves then are tied to. And I'll come back to this shortly as to whether or not any of the other medium or low prior or low hazards are ones that maybe you do want to elevate up. Not play with the scores, but just know that maybe picking up transportation. Even though it's scored a medium, we'd like to have mitigation strategies in that regard. So just setting the stage there. The plan itself has three overarching goals. These are protecting lives and reducing injury, minimizing or reducing damage to property, especially critical facilities and infrastructure, and then strengthening communication among agencies and between agencies and the public regarding hazard mitigation. So the plan itself, again, is multi-jurisdictional, so all the communities and school districts and Story County Board of Supervisors sign on to this, and these are our common goals. And then the strategies for which are selected, or the strategies that are selected to match then the goals. And I'll go to the state worksheet with you here shortly. I don't want you to look at that and try to read it, but that is the spreadsheet that was delivered to me. This is what I was asked to review as the current plan's mitigation strategies, and then how, whether they're ongoing or give an update and then amend for new strategies. What I've done is simplified that.
Okay.
For you all. I just wanted you to get a snapshot of what problems I'm faced with and what I have to deal with. But going to those top five hazards, river flood is our greatest hazard which we face. And if you see on the... You can't see because of the screen up there.
I have the hazards for which we have mitigation strategies in red. They're river flood, tornado slash windstorm, and grass wildland fire. In our current hazard mitigation plan, even though grass wildland fire scores a medium ranking, 4 or 5 years ago, the board still said we want to have a mitigation strategy on that.
And all I'm going to say is you have to remember what that board was facing, and that was exactly when the Stover pile started to become a thing. Mm-hmm. And so this probably took a look. This gathered a little more, had a little more gravity to it at that point than it would have at some other time.
So I can only eventually get to that discussion. But for river flood, the current strategies are continued promotion and participation in the National Flood Insurance Program, and then enrollment and support in the NFIP Community Rating System Program for the unincorporated areas of Story County, which we are continuing to accomplish both. We did go into the Class 7 community for the CRS. So my recommendation is that these still remain as mitigation strategies in regards to river flood, but perhaps we'll look at enhancing them. But at the minimum, we do need to continue both.
Absolutely.
What I do want to turn your attention to, though, is this worksheet that I put on everyone's desk before the meeting started. What I need to do on my end of what I've been doing, I do a worksheet on both the current and the proposed mitigation strategies. So if you look, I identify the jurisdiction, you know, which strategy, to which goal it adheres. Have to do cost estimates if available. It's a whole worksheet I go through. It's the Stately, as well as STATLEE. This is how we use to actually decide which mitigation strategy ultimately is incorporated into the plan. So every community is doing this.
And you have to do a separate worksheet
for every strategy.
For every strategy.
Okay. There's a lot of homework that goes into that.
And just a correction, every jurisdiction has been asked to fill out one of these duties. If you don't do one of these, it just means you're not eligible for some grants and some assistance down the road.
Yeah, that's a good clarification. So river flood, next one is the tornado slash windstorm. Mm-hmm. The mitigation strategies that were put in the plan 4 or 5 years ago were promoting constructing tornado safe rooms on county-owned properties. Obviously, we've made some progress towards that with the Hickory Grove shelter. The second element that was included, or strategy, was study the value of adoption, enforcement, and building codes. That was actually struck then out of the plan 3 years ago. So that is actually not a mitigation strategy, but still it is. Our consultant delivered it to us, so I just needed to share it and say my comment back to them will be this is not a critical strategy. Any questions on tornado slash windstorm? Then the grass wildland fire, again, as Rick said, the Stover piles were starting to become an issue. We knew we had we had the Skunk River Greenbelt. Some issues with that could potentially arise. So it's developed and implemented a program to provide wildfire training and preventative measures. Really nothing has occurred on this from a standpoint of an update.
Could we go back to the mitigation strategy that was struck for tornado and windstorm?
Sure.
So that was a previous board or 3 years, maybe 6 years ago. Okay.
It was 3 years ago.
Oh, okay. That struck it. But then originally it had been put on by an older board.
It had never been put on by a board. It came forward from the consultants that built this plan. So when we built the plan 5 years ago, consultants put it in there. Board of Supervisors discussed it, decided there was no appetite from that board to put building codes. Right? And that's how it got struck.
That I wondered how it'd come in front of the board, the discussion.
Yep.
But now, thank you very much. Okay.
Yep.
Going on. Okay.
The other hazards and strategies, there are several strategies that go across the board for all the hazards. Even if they're not the high or medium, even the low strategies. These are just common, you know, having outreach strategies. I mean, very common. Those I would recommend stay in. Those
They really benefit us. They can be added easily into work programs. In fact, they are folded into the various department work programs. So that's our current strategy. Now what I want to get to is just some discussion on potential items. So what I did is I went to the C2C plan, the implementation matrix, and the plan itself. These are just some ideas I'm putting out there for food for thought, just for today, for you to just chew on and see if you think anything jumps out and then give me some direction. Of course.
Will you just be emailing this to us later?
Yeah, I mean, I can't read it.
Okay.
Well, I hate to read slides, but I'm going to just talk through a little bit each of these. Identify evaluating water quality programs and best management practices. Last night, we had our watershed assessment report released. A lot of these relate to that. So I think if you have, and specifically in regards to river floods and flash floods, those two hazards, if you have a more robust statement or strategy that ties back to that watershed assessment, and whether that's considering implementation of the recommendations in the watershed assessment or consider further implementation of watershed management authorities. But I do think you need to do some way to address water quality programs and best management practices back in the hazard mitigation plan. So I would suggest you have a strategy in that regard. Developing a density-based zoning program. I know this is, I believe this is on the work program for planning and development. But that would, you know, relate back to the overall strategies for all the different hazards. You already have in a work program. I think it'd be logical direction to have it in the hazard mitigation plan as well. Continue participation in the HUD level. HUD-led hazard control program and encourage communities to consider joining when opportunity arises. I don't know if you actually need to build this into the hazard mitigation plan as part of the C2C plan, but what I tried to do was identify implementation tests that had a logical nexus back to the hazard mitigation plan and potential mitigation strategies.
Leanne, if we had a hazard mitigation plan, period, just a plan, then we qualify for any type of disaster, or do we need to have a mitigation strategy for that particular disaster, type of disaster?
Yes, you qualify, and no, you don't have to have a mitigation strategy for every hazard.
Thank you. Okay.
So,
but
yeah.
You want to go ahead?
No, go for
okay.
it.
But by having a strategy lined up to a specific concern, you qualify for dollars for mitigation for that concern that you don't otherwise qualify for. So the temptation here, Lawrence, is, well, let's do it all. But then you end up and get 5 years down the road. So look pretty carefully at what we had here for the last 5 years and go through what did the county accomplish over the last 5 years. And the reality is we accomplished most of all of this. We accomplished pieces of all of this. And so I would encourage us, if we see something that we think over the next 5 years is really going to be a focus of Story County, that we're really going to get done, then absolutely we include it. But we're making a mistake. We're being short-sighted if we just include things for the sake of including them. Does that make sense?
And that confirms what the consultant said for the last meeting, because he said, if you don't think you can do it,
don't put it in there. Right.
Or at least make an attempt.
If it's not going to be a priority,
right,
then we get done.
Okay.
Which is a logical reason to look at the C2C implementation matrix and see if there's any strategies in there that have an element of a hazard mitigation plan, such, or something on it. It's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
Continue offering radon test kits. Developing and implementing information regarding public safety to be available at community facilities. Again, one of the overall outreach that would probably fall under all the hazards. Audit regulations to determine whether we have smart development practices that limit disaster impacts.
Talk about that one for just a second.
This is one of those items in the C2C plan and the implementation matrix that I am not 100% clear about what it means. So if you ask me, would I recommend building this into the mitigation plan at this point, I don't think I would.
That's the one that I look at that just concerns me, because I'm not sure exactly what we're talking about getting into for that one.
Yeah, but it has a language, disaster impacts, that's mitigation, some mitigation language. I'm still not
I'm still trying to chew this one up and understand what, you know, give the whole flavor for it, for what it means for the C2C plan implementation.
Okay.
I think Jerry's staff might be in the same boat, too.
Okay.
Then, develop and implement requirements for groundwater impact analyses. Actually, it flows back into that general watershed assessment. That's why I started by on that one saying there's several that could be lumped together. Identify and encourage stormwater best management practices for county approved projects. You heard some information about that last night. Water quality improvement strategies in drainage districts. Again, reiterating what I just said. And then the last one is communicate with the DOT, UP, IEDA, and IDOT on the freight optimization program. We have a hazard that relates to transportation and hazardous materials. This could be one that we could fold in there to make that relationship with the C2C plan. That's from the implementation matrix. There are some strategies in the C2C plan itself that have not made their way up to the implementation plan. And these deal with siting special needs facilities, making sure we have information available for county residents and visitors, and then encouraging long-range sanitary sewer system planning in cities. I think these are ones that we could build into, but I think they're pretty generic at this time. So what I would recommend next year, when we're doing an update of the hazard mitigation plan, which we look at annually, we go back and look at these strategies and see if they've made their way into the implementation matrix itself of the C2C plan, as we have that discussion.
Okay.
And then possibly build them into the hazard mitigation plan, kind of layering on itself. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying? Okay. So the next steps, just some feedback today, and then I go back and I do the state plan analysis, even on the current ones, which I've done that, but...
But for any of the, two slides ago, any of those bullet points that we send her out here with, she's going to do a full analysis on.
Or something else you've heard discussions on. I'll present them back officially. Not for official action. That will occur until you actually approve the plan. But that will get more defined action next week. And we actually do have a hazard mitigation plan committee meeting on June 25th. So those will be folded into the draft plan at that point.
Okay.
So we've
got to go back to that. So here's what I'd like us to talk about right here. So I don't like the audit regulations to determine whether we have smart development policies, because I don't think we clearly define what that means at this point. And so I don't think we can put something in that we have clearly defined what it means. And then the second one is, I loved our meeting last night. I thought it was a great meeting to receive that report, and now it's going to be really interesting to see what we do with those assessments and how that impacts everything else. I don't see rolling anything having to do with water quality into our hazard mitigation strategies, which are primarily, at least here in Story County, talking about flooding rather than the quality of the flood. And I think it's just extra work that doesn't belong in our hazard mitigation plan or our hazard mitigation strategies. And I think that's three different bullet points.
Four.
That's four bullet points.
Yeah. It's the first and then the last, second, the last three of the four, starting with developing and implementing requirements for groundwater impact analyses.
Of those four dealing with the groundwater in itself, those we might be ready for, future boards, okay, could be ready to look at those, but we're in no way close to being able to put it in this plan because we don't even know in part what that looks like and in part getting that done.
I think they're like a step actually behind the C2C plan strategies. I said maybe we look at next year.
Okay.
Because they're actually not folded into the C2C plan yet.
Okay.
I mean, we have an idea of what the recommendations are, but you have not had a formal discussion on those.
Okay.
So
the one that we might be close to out of those is identify and encourage stormwater best management practices for county approved projects, because I feel us starting to get some momentum along that. I don't feel that with the other. I mean, we got two steps to take just to get started. So, Leanne, do you think I'm way off base with what I'm suggesting for these?
No.
So Marty, Laura, you guys got to decide what we're sending Leanne out to deal with.
And we don't necessarily need to have new ones either.
We don't need to, but it's appropriate that we would identify some additional items, but we better intend to get through them if we're going to identify them.
I would love to have your freight optimization, the last one, but you know, you are tethering yourself to the fact that Union Pacific is going to talk to you. And we have seen that be a loose connection at best.
Mm-hmm.
Because the thing is they put that high speed rail line through the city of Ames, and they put that through the city of Nevada, and I live a mile and a half north of it. And there's clearly freight that goes through that has a public endangering quality about it that we don't know about. That you were just, but once again, when you start seeing partners that you would have to, combine with, that would be hard to rope everybody in.
Well, it would be, but if they won't communicate with us, it doesn't mean that we didn't try on that. I mean, I see that list. The Iowa DOT is going to communicate with us. I suspect as we look at the East Industrial area that the IEDA, there will be some conversations in some way because people are looking at that area maybe because of the freight capacities. So that, but I agree with you about UP.
Yeah.
But if we move forward to try and determine that, I know that just from the local emergency planning committee, okay, I know that they're discussing some of what's coming through the county now. I'm sure they're discussing an emergency management commission, right, Rick?
So, oh, yeah.
So we may be doing more than we think. We just need to all share.
Well, so the three we talk about the most in the emergency management commission is definitely river flood, definitely major tornado, but hazardous material still, specifically UP. I mean, you have, so worst case scenario, you have a train carrying some really, really bad stuff going east that collides with a truck at Duff Avenue and derails right there in downtown Ames, right? That is worst of the worst case scenario. And so for me, this one carries a little more weight. But while I'm with you that we may not be able to get there, when I wake up in the middle of the night thinking about these things, yeah, it's river flood and how we would deal with that. It's an F5 tornado coming. You know, we practice that coming right through Story County, and it's a hazardous materials train that derails in either Ames or Nevada.
Well, that's where I'm at for that very reason alone, because once you learn the story of what moves without you having any real knowledge of it, if you're not concerned, once you know, you can't know what you've been made aware of, and now we are aware of that. How do we not try to step in that direction?
So, Marty, I'd like to keep that bottom one in. I think you make a great point that that one's not going to be easy to achieve, and there's lots of moving parts there, but I still think that that's one of our responsibilities to try to push. It may be pushing a rope for it. I mean, we have to get a lot done, but I think that's one of our responsibilities. I'd like to take the water quality ones out, and I'd like to take the smart practices out and not even have Leanne worry about filling out the worksheet on those.
I'm agreeable with that.
Hard as 1 year, and the thing is trying to get something done, and this sounds like we're taking on really the hardest of which to do, with knowing that there's probably the most likelihood of being a worst-case scenario attached. Yeah. So let's put one upon ourselves, and let's hope we get lucky.
Right.
I just have to say, this is the first time I've had the benefit of having C2C plan to go back to and set the stage for this type of discussion. And we're not reinventing things at this point. We're building on work that's already been done.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, we're way ahead of where we were 5 years ago when we first tried to take this on. Anything else that you need from us, Leanne, and are we clear enough in what we're asking you for?
I don't need anything else, and that's fair enough.
All right.
I just like to see that slide. You know, the two that I can't read. You would look like
I know I was leaning forward to.
Okay.
You weren't alone.
All right.
Yeah, you're back.
We're going to take a 2 minute. We're going to take a 2 minute. Reason we're done with you, Armand.
I have more stuff.
Right now?
I have another agenda item.
Yeah, coming late.
Yeah.
Right, but now?
No, it's good.
Okay, well, let's do that, and then we'll, while Leanne's sitting here. Okay, so we're to Economic Development Planning Workforce Development Services with the Ames Economic Development Commission, renewing that contract.
Just quickly on the Workforce Development Services, the draft changes that are before you this morning are increasing the amount of payment from $25,000 to $40,000 for the budget discussions. And then I did talk to Lisa Marfleish, given our current, the way this fiscal year is ending up and starting, she did ask that payment not be, it did say July 1st. It's now pushed back to July 31st. So I did send these to, both of these, to Ames Economic Development Commission, which is a segue to go into economic development services, unless you have questions on the workforce development.
Any questions on workforce?
None.
Good.
What's in front of you now is a proposed changes from Ames Chamber and Economic Development Commission for the economic development services. Really, the heart of the changes are on page 2. Some proposed amendments to language on number 7.
And that's a change just to reflect what's really happening.
Okay. And then, again, the payment, I didn't highlight it, but on page 3, pushing the payment back to July 31st.
And you communicated with Dan and Amy on that one?
I think I did.
All right. Questions on the strike-through on number 7?
Was there a rationale given for the why we're changing it? To me, it seems to be basically the same group of services. We've just made it shorter, information and guidance as opposed to anything else. Is that the way I'm thinking here?
I think just to make it more clean and just...
Yeah, so Brenda, I'd look to you. I know Dan couldn't stay, but it looks to me like you guys are proposing this change because it meets more closely what is really happening, and just make sure that's reflected in the contract. And nodding at affirmation.
Okay, so the one thing then, as it's where in obtaining financial incentives, if applicable, just wanting to make sure that's what you're doing is you're counseling them about what's available, not encouraging them to come for anything, right? You're just letting them know what's available through the various programs. Okay,
And it's beyond just Story County, right? So as they're advising them, they're talking about other incentives and other programs that are state, that are anything and everything. And so I think your responsibility is to make sure they're aware of the tools that are out there that they could potentially use.
Okay, and Mike, we have not given economic incentives so far, so that was just my concern that we're not getting them presented in front of people and then thinking that the county could do this when the county may not have an appetite or have never done that before. Okay, so, all right.
Well, I think you've seen it, Lawrence, you out there too, where you see different levels of knowledge on what's available both on the county and on the state level, and potentially do a national branding level. So
right.
I think Brenda does and has done a fine job of blurring that story. So I don't think there's any representation if there's any financial reward talking to her, nor is she offering.
Right. Okay. So I just want to make sure in my own mind, because like I said, I mean, it's really shortened it up. It's very clear now. So yeah, I'm fine with it.
You can make the motion for me.
I move that we accept the
direction. Yeah. Today is just getting direction that these changes look okay. Next Tuesday's consent agenda will have the official.
So to go through this on consent. Perfect.
Okay.
Any questions or comments that you want before this comes back to us on consent?
None other than I appreciate how the AUDC has continued to work with the board to meet our concerns and our needs every year. So thank you.
They do a phenomenal job. I mean, Story County is in a better place now since going down this road, and thank you guys. Thanks, Leanne. Now we're going to take a 2-minute recess because I need you. Quorum back.
Okay,
hold on. Yep, let me know.
Have a quorum.
Okay, go.
All right. So we are to discussion and consideration of resolution 18-118. Amelia, and our first visit from Ryan.
Yeah. Hi, Ryan.
Hi.
So I'm going to do this one, and then Ryan's going to do the next one.
Okay.
Okay, we're sharing today.
Thank you.
So So this is a residential parcel subdivision at 55013 282nd Street. It is east of Kelly and north of Hoxie. The applicant is Ryan Holland. He's here today. If you have any questions for him, and the property owner is Rita Doherty. This is zoned A1 Agricultural. I've got some of the utility and emergency service provider districts listed here. It is in the Walnut Creek watershed. Walnut Creek does run through the property as well. And so there is some natural resources area, as well as ag conservation designation in our CGC plan on the property that you'll see. So again, this is the location. You can see here is Highway 69. And then just to the east is the subject property. It is a quarter-quarter section. So we're creating two lots that are rather large. One's 22 acres approximately. That will have the existing dwelling and farmstead on it. And one is 15.2 net acres, which is buildable for a single-family dwelling. Proposed lot two that is buildable does have approximately 7 acres in agricultural row crops here. Those will remain for this season. It's up to the new buyer if they're going to keep those or not.
Right.
There is an existing farm access as well that the county engineer has indicated will need to be the access for Emo Inn.
Okay.
And here's the plat map. And then this is, you can see Walnut Creek, and there is FEMA designated floodplain. A little bit more on the current land use. You can see the majority of the area is wooded, with the exception of those row crops. And the existing dwelling has a few accessory structures associated, and it was built in 1920. Because Walnut Creek does flow through just that northwestern section of the property, that we did require a stream easement that's shown in the plat, and we have a written document as well. And this is the future land use map of the area. So in our C2C plan, you can see that the wooded area is designated as natural area. The Ames Urban Fringe Plan does touch this corner as well, and it is also a natural area in the Ames Urban Fringe Plan. Ames defers to the county in this designation. And so we read it to them, they deferred to our review. Regarding the ag conservation future land use designation, which is the not shaded area, it's not a colored area. There are a few principles that I want to discuss. Typically, we would discourage development in high-value agricultural areas. This is a 7-acre area in row crops. The property owner doesn't own adjacent parcels. It's a low crop suitability rating. And really, if this agricultural area were to be developed for residential use, it may protect the natural area instead. So I think there's some trade-offs that we can say are being made that make this meet the principles of our C2C plan's future land use map for this area. Regarding adjacent properties, there is a subdivision adjacent to the east. It's the Klongman subdivision. It's zoned AR agricultural residential and has 8 dwellings. To the north, you have property owned by Iowa State, used for agricultural purposes. East, there is a large parcel with a dwelling. It's zoned A1 agricultural. And to the south, you have several large agricultural parcels and one smaller parcel of a farmstead on it. Within a half mile, there's 48 parcels and 23 dwellings and 13 parcels that meet our minimum size requirements to obtain the zoning permit to construct a dwelling. And one final note on the current land use and site. Upon site review, we noticed there were quite a few vehicles that did not look like they were in use. So we asked the applicant about that. Being that this is a subdivision and somebody will be building a house. And so they have provided a compliance schedule for a timeline to remove the vehicles, as well as a barn that had recently been dismantled that was located on the property. We have some photos of that as well. The staff has agreed on the July 12th compliance schedule, and we'll be following up on that administratively. So this is looking east on 282nd at the proposed lot 2, the agricultural parcel. This is looking north at proposed lot 2, and looking west on 282nd towards proposed lot 1, the dwelling is located here. This is the existing dwelling.
This is looking south towards 282nd from the property. This is the barn that we discussed the compliance schedule for. And these are some of the vehicles, and you can see some of the other accessory structures located on the property. Here are already applicable regulations for a residential parcel subdivision. I'm not going to go through these, but I need them. And then we did go through interagency review. County departments had a few comments that we've already discussed. Mike with County Conservation noted the natural area should be avoided for development. And Margaret noted that there isn't septic information on the existing dwelling. And so they should consider an upgrade. Was her comment.
Do we have any ability to require that upgrade, though? Because it's not, the property's really not changing hands.
Mm-hmm. The proposed lot line isn't.
We'll have the ability, we will require it on any new structure built on lot two.
Yes, but not on lot one.
We also mailed notification letters to property owners within a quarter mile and have not received any comments. And we also sent this to the city of Huxley because they're exactly 2 miles away and they reviewed it and approved the subdivision. And again, we routed this to the city of Mays and Gilbert because of the needs of refurbishment. So a few points of analysis. All the requirements for a residential parcel subdivision are met. Both lots have frontage. There is natural resources area and agricultural conservation area on the property, but policies for these designations are met, including because of the small size of the row crops and the low value of the agricultural land. We do have requirements for protection of natural resources in our land development regulations in case they were to be impacted, including that you can't remove more than 15%. There's mitigation requirements for trees. We have a stream easement on the plat as well for Walnut Creek. And again, this subdivision will create 2 lots for 2 dwellings in the quarter. They're very large lots, both over 15 acres. These are your alternatives. We are recommending alternative one, which is approval as presented without conditions. And if you have any questions for me, I can try to answer those, or again, the applicants here as well.
Absolutely. And I like what you said. I mean, so we're talking about 7 acres of row crops that probably will come out of production at some point. Mm-hmm. But the trade-off for that is now we have the ability to protect that natural area that's back there in the back that we wouldn't have leaving it in row crops. So great presentation. I appreciate it. Ryan, you've sat through a lot of stuff today. You got anything you want to say to us before we take action on this?
Your question, you got fired.
I don't smell smoke.
Well, okay. Coming back to the septic, and the thought of a straight pipe, for one thing, is on my mind after the presentation last night. We talked about groundwater and everything. And since the septic hasn't been permitted or inspected or permitted, I'm concerned about that going forward. Do you have information on the septic about where it's located exactly or where it drains?
Yeah, I mean, if there's nothing on file with the county, we would have undertaken to look at it. It's not a requirement of the code, so it's not something that we would take time, money, and effort to look at. I will tell you, based on the age of the owner, that septic is going to be looked at some point in the not too distant future because of the time.
When the property changes hands is when the county will get together.
As long as it doesn't go to a deceased. You think it'll actually be sold, is what you think.
Well, if you want to record a deed, whether it's, there's all sorts of exceptions on the grandfather ownership, but if I want a deed recorded by the recorder's office, they will require contact.
Oh, they will require it even if it is a family member.
If there's a deed and I want it recorded,
okay.
Not like a well where it just gets passed to the next guy in that road. I want a deed recorded. Now, there are exceptions, but.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, thank you. My concern has been noted.
Okay. Any other concerns or questions? All right. If not, I would take a motion on Resolution 18-118.
I move consideration of Resolution 18-118, the Notary Residential Parcel Subdivision as presented.
I second.
Motion and second. Further discussion. Anything else we need to know, Billy?
Nope.
Thank
you.
Keating.
Aye.
Olson.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Resolution 18-118 passes. Thanks, Ryan. Did you have any idea how much you were going to learn today when you came?
Old Jerry, it's like when you show up to church on Sunday and it's baptism. Oh, I'll be good.
Okay, next, we get to hear from Ryan talking to us about Resolution 18-117.
That's right, another residential parcel subdivision here. The property owner is in attendance as well for any questions. We are at 65343 300 Fifth Street, just north of Maxwell, and it's in an A1 agricultural zoning district, as well as the Indian Creek watershed, and the rest of the districts are listed there. So Maxwell is kind of outlined right here, and here's our property. And this is the proposed subdivision. So lot one has an existing dwelling and will be about 2.5 net acres. And then lot two will consist of this area here, which will be buildable for a single family dwelling. Both have frontage on 305th Street here. There is no driveway to lot two at this time, but one would be allowed if a permit was submitted. And it's important here that there is no immediate plans for a dwelling on lot two. All lots will be for sale. Here's the survey. Okay, a little background. The existing parcel was created in 95 when it was divided from the parcel to the north, and it was buildable at that time, so a dwelling was constructed in 96 as it met an exception to the minimum 35-acre requirement because a farmstead was found. A majority of the lot is covered in trees, with the remainder basically just open grassland. Proposed lot two is buildable. However, like we said, there are no current plans at this time for development. An interesting portion here is this is just to the north of our subject property, and it is a 7.39 net acre parcel of native prairie. It is not buildable and obviously doesn't have frontage to 305th either. Is a little bit of a concern if this parcel becomes owned by an individual other than an owner to, you know, either of these adjacent land, you know, they wouldn't have the frontage, and at that point an access easement would be required with a minimum of 20 feet in width, according to the Story County Land Development Regulations 88.04. And so we've communicated that to the property owner, and we have written confirmation that that would occur. Given
as
this
long as they own one of the two properties to the south, we're still fine.
Yeah, so either propose lot one or two, or, you know, possibly this landowner or this landowner as well. And so, like I said, we have written confirmation that that would occur if it comes to be the case. So here is a little bit of an outer view as well. So all of this land here is A1 agricultural. There's a dwelling here. Here's our native prairie parcel, and then row crops. We have Rolling Hills subdivision across the 305th to the south, and that's R1. So that's kind of the surrounding land, and we have another dwelling right here. Okay, so portions of the subdivision are designated as a natural resource area, kind of in this area and in the C2C plan. So, and we discussed with the property owner as well about the some of the mitigation requirements, the 15% of naturally occurring resources, if they shall be removed. So no more than 15 shall be removed. And so understanding of all those requirements has been confirmed. This is at the driveway looking east on 305th, then west on 305th, up the driveway, standing in 305th. And then this is the existing dwelling on proposed lot 1. This is that native prairie parcel to the north. This is looking north. And looking northeast onto proposed lot 2, kind of the clearing there. And then basically on 305th, looking west onto proposed lot 2, the treed area. So all the applicable regulations are right here. Again, we won't go through all of them because they have been met. And so when we went through the interagency review, again, the engineer stated a driveway to proposed lot 2 would be possible. The location would be determined at the time of permit submission. The house and septic are contained on proposed lot 1, and there are no easements. And as well, from the assessor, proposed lot 2 will be valued as buildable residential for the 2019 assessment. Again, the applicant is aware of the issue and will provide the access easement if the northern prairie parcel is sold to anyone other than an adjacent landowner.
I was going to jump in here. We did provide notice within a quarter mile, and at the time of writing the staff report, had not received any comments, but we did receive one last night from a property owner to the southeast. And they had a few concerns. They didn't say that they objected to the actual division, but had concerns about where the house may be constructed. Specifically, if the tree buffer would be maintained to the farm fields, and if a new driveway would be constructed. You know, again, we have setback requirements, 40 feet from rear property lines, 10 feet from side property lines that will apply. We have natural resource mitigation standards that will apply. The 15% of natural resources shall not be removed without mitigation. And the county engineer did note, though, that they didn't need to do a shared driveway if they need to do one. So beyond other requirements in the land development regulations for setbacks and natural resources, you don't really have requirements of where you can build. So I just wanted to note that, and I have a copy if you'd like to see it as well.
Yeah. I would encourage this individual. I tell you, there's a simple way that they can decide where the house is built and where the driveway is. And I think the lot's going to be for sale at some point. They could just buy it, and then they'd have complete control.
And then we did also wrap the cities within 2 miles, and Maxwell addressed this item and waived their review.
Okay, so to finish up with the analysis, all requirements have been met. Both lots would have frontage. The subject property is designated as rural residential on the C2C plan and consistent with all of the policies for the designation. No ag land will be taken out of production if development occurs. As well as all regulations will apply to any future development in the natural resource area. The natural prairie parcel without frontage to the north is unbuildable, and like we said, there's been confirmation that the access will be allowed if it becomes owned by anyone other than an adjacent landowner. And then there are 47 parcels located within a half mile of the subject property. 20, including the subject property, contain dwellings, and 15 also meet the minimum lot size requirement to construct a dwelling. And then, as you saw earlier, Rolling Hills subdivision is zoned R1 residential, located to the south across the street.
Directly to the south, virtually right across that. Right.
Yeah. So, staff recommend approval of the Pheasant Run residential parcel subdivision, which is alternative one highlighted there.
Okay.
Questions for us?
Questions. And we have the applicant here as well. So, comments or questions?
None.
This is just another installment of what goes on in this neighborhood, just an outgrowth of it. So I have no qualms in it.
Make the motion.
And I would move consideration of resolution 18-117, Pheasant Run Residential Partial Subdivision as presented. Very good job, Ryan.
That's good.
I would second.
Motion and a second. Any further discussion? Chief.
Aye.
Olson.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Resolution 18-117 passes. Good job, Ryan. Thank you. No departmental reports today. Other reports, strategic plan process overview and discussion. Leanne, and we also have Clint Sloth and Terry Meyer with us.
Good morning.
Hopefully you're getting some work done back there in the conference room.
We did.
I'm not saying much other than introducing these two to you and letting them run the show.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. So I'm Clint Sloth. This is Terry.
Nice to meet you all.
Hi there.
Okay. And so we just wanted to be here to, we are going to meet with Leanne afterwards and really kind of dig into some of the finer details of the next steps in the process. As you know, you guys signed the agreement last week. And we are just, moving forward now with gathering data and information. So we wanted to come here and kind of walk through the process with you as well as meet with Leanne afterwards. So you have your handout here that we provided. To give you kind of a little bit of an overview. Looking at step one, the project kickoff. Again, leading up to the proposal for the project and even our interview, when we met with your committee, we just really wanted to note and highlight that your current strategic plan is very similar to our process as far as, laying out the areas, topic areas, and the objectives below that. So there's really not too much difference between how we do and how you've done it, so that's great. And your plan has been effective. You see, you've done a lot already, so that's good to see in a very short period of time.
We take it really seriously.
Yeah.
We believe not only in the exercise but in the results of the exercise.
Absolutely. And as part of the kickoff step in this phase, we're meeting with staff, really figure out logistics, get things figured out as far as the schedule. This is basically a 12-week process from start to finish. We are an hour in week two in that process. So collecting data, collecting reports, gathering information, speaking to department heads, getting that feedback from them. It's kind of an entry point to the process. As far as also providing an online survey for additional feedback from the public.
When do you talk to the supervisors individually to determine any changes they or additions they would like into the strategic plan?
That would be an early on step in the process as well. That's time to talk with Leanne about as how we get you guys involved in that conversation. We weren't sure if you wanted to do it individually or as a board meeting, so we just wanted that as part of our discussion with Leanne.
With the open meetings law, two of us make, okay. So I was thinking more about, this is my first time going through the process here, right? So mine was thinking about if I wanted to talk about, my personal thoughts about where I'd like to see the board go in the future. That's really what I was looking at, as opposed to when a draft is brought to all of us to then talk about and vote on.
And Clint just said, though, that's why we're here today, is to get some direction from you three, how you want us to proceed in that. Mm-hmm. So do you want us to put it on next week's agenda again as an actual discussion item, or not next, just say, for example,
yeah.
An official public meeting, or do you want them to come up, like we did with the C2C plan, where I know Rick, you were the only one that experienced that, where the consulting team met with each of the supervisors one-on-one, and then that got folded through the process as well.
Yeah, and I think that would be my expectation, and I think that's an appropriate way to operate, is early on, find a time to meet with each one of us. Then we're the decision-making body, right? So at the end of the day, we get to decide what this thing looks like. But I think it's appropriate for each of us to have our inputs early on when you can actually impact some of the direction that it's going, and give you guys food for thought as you're out gathering information.
Absolutely.
And we'll just count on Leanne to get that put together.
With her on that. And then from, this 3-4 week phase of kickoff, data collection, interview process, we lead into the workshop phase. So I'll let Terry kind of take that over.
Well, real quickly on that, what we'll do is once we get the feedback from the department heads, and the supervisors will have a clear understanding of your priorities as we move forward, whether they reflect your current goals or what. Again, like Clint said, our process is very similar to the one you use. So there's our plans are so locally tailored that we can manipulate them however you'd want to. So we'd first have the department heads identify all the projects, the issues, the concerns based on your capital improvements plan, based on your comprehensive plan, to formulate some projects specifics, look at their budgets, look at, those outside resources that might be available so that we can help better define the goals of the county. Then at that process, once that process is complete, then we're going to go through some sort of a prioritization process. And again, at this point, it's a little bit uncertain whether we have the department heads prioritize them, bring them back to you in a public meeting to say these are priority one, priority two, priority three. That's why we're here today, is to work with Leanne to kind of hammer out those details. But we're going to be tailored enough to meet whatever your individual needs
are. Terry, I think you're expressing exactly the way I see this thing progressing, whether Loris and Marty want to tweak what you're suggesting. But that it's what we followed before. Yep. In the county. Mm-hmm. I would note that, so you refer to department heads, and you're 100% right, you're going to be visiting with department heads. But here at the county level, we also have other elected officials, in your mind, you're probably lumping in, even though they're autonomous.
Yep.
Entities. It's going to be really important that you get lots of feedback from them. Then I think as you gather the information and you start to think about building our strategic plan, it's completely appropriate for us to sit down in a work session,
right,
the three of us, and go through and say, yeah, we like this, or we like this item better than that, start to lay out what we're going to expect to see from a final plan that we might approve.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Loris, Marty, do you see it differently than that?
No, I think it's going to be a sorting process, because the thing is, I think we each have our own priorities. I think Loris is probably where you were going on an individual basis.
Yeah.
I guess I did not know how the previous board had handled the implementation of the CTC, but if you did it on an individual basis, I'd say, well, that was successful. Why don't we just sit there and follow along, do the same thing, and then bring it back on a work session.
And C2C is important in all this, that process, but what I'm thinking about is more the two previous times. So the first time we had to create a strategic plan out of nothing.
Sure.
It was a little more complex. Then we came back, and it was we were still dealing with a fairly new strategic plan, so it was just a matter of updating.
Right.
Now I think we've made the exact right choice in going in, and yes, we got something to build on, but it doesn't mean we've got to follow exactly what it is. We've got kind of a new bite at the apple right here, and I think we take full advantage of it. But I think it goes, you guys lay out the process that you see,
yep,
then individual meetings, gathering information, then an opportunity for the board collectively to weigh in on what you found and what directions you think you're going in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
For ultimately a final product to come back to the board for us to adopt or amend or...
Right.
If that makes sense.
That's perfect. That's exactly what we were planning on doing.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, like I said, this is a newer role. This is a new role for me. Marty's been through the Innovative School Board. He was president for a long time. So I'm good with that, though. That sounds like exactly kind of how I envisioned it. Once I figured out, we'd each have an opportunity to kind of throw our stuff in the pot to see if it stays.
Like whatever we choose to take up and apply, that's what we call our plan.
Okay.
Anything else we need for you guys to be able to get going? 12 weeks is going to go fast.
It is.
I think it's a matter of meeting with Leanne and just really hammering out some of those details, really, at this point. So.
Good. Leanne, anything you need from us on clarity?
The only question I do have is, last 3 years ago, we did involve the chairpersons of the Planning and Zoning Commission and Board of Health and Conservation Board. I can't remember if it was Board of Adjustment as well. Do you want to go in that?
I think there's value in involving the chair of those groups. I mean, we're going to get to hear from department heads, but I believe there's value in hearing from the chair people of those groups.
The VA Commission, too.
Yeah. I like that. It's a second voice from each of those areas, and so I like that. More information. Right. Better than too little information.
And we've identified 20 off your website, 20 offices and departments. And so when we get some feedback from these, do we, I guess, put them into those main topic areas that you identified previously? Or do you want something else by each?
So I would say completely appropriate for you guys to be heavily aware of what we've done before, but don't feel like you're bound by that.
Right. Perfect. Okay. Perfect. Sounds good.
Anything else? Thank you, guys. Looking forward to seeing you tomorrow.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Public forum number two. This is an opportunity for members of the public to comment on anything you want to comment on. When it can't take any action, but we can sure hear you. Anybody wishing to speak to us, come on up. Seeing no one moving to the microphone, liaison assignments. Dolores, I think you're first this week.
Oh, well, let's see. Earlier, Marion stole my thunder about Boost and the child care emphasis. Okay. Aging Resource meets Thursday, so I go from the young to the not so young. Still doing presentations, so tonight I'm going to go to the. Huh? I'm still crusading. That's right. I'm still pushing, finding out what people think about the county getting involved in some kind of grant program. And tonight I'll find out from the Ames City Council whether they're going to put me on their agenda for the 26th or not. They follow a little different procedure than I think our smaller counties do. Somebody from the council will have to refer it to and say, we'll do this. Okay. Yeah. And I was sent... kudos to the Conservation Department. I was swimming at Hickory Grove at both Saturday and Sunday and found it very enjoyable. So if you listen to this tape later, you'll discover that my husband and I were both pleased with the water quality and the parklands looked pretty good. Down there, the beach looks pretty good. And so the staff was nice and friendly. So good job there. And pretty much that's it.
Good. Thank you. Marty.
Long enough meeting. Just to say that I had a wonderful meeting out at McFarland last night with the combined departments, staffs of planning and zoning and conservation and us. And it will be interesting to see what all comes of that. That said, you made reference early in the meeting that there was some damage done by a weather event that went through last week to Tell. Could you tell us about that?
No.
Fairly, so less damage probably than we would have expected based on the fact that we got almost 6 inches of rain, but more damage than we liked, particularly one area of the stream after the confluence. So this is further east on the property just before the wetland area. We had kind of a little oxbow that there was substantial damage done. We don't have a real estimate yet on what that's going to cost, but Mike Cox is working with Keith Morgan to make sure it's part of our assessment. It's hard to imagine that it's not going to be close to six figures to fix the damage that was done. They are well at work on phase two, and actually there's, if the weather cooperates, we could be starting to see some hard surfaces out there in the next week or 10 days. And so there's some exciting stuff going on. Most of the stream and the places that we had planted, those several hundred willows that we planted, maintained their integrity really well.
Okay.
And there's just a couple areas generally where we were changing direction of water. And in this one place that we took some pretty substantial damage, it's a major shift in the flow of water, and when you get 6 inches and it's all running at the same time, it decides it wants to go straight wherever possible. So that's the update.
Thank you.
Yep. Absolutely. Anything else for us? If not, I'd take a motion to adjourn.
I'll move.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
For adjourn. 12:50.